Okay, I'd like to start the hearing. We're not going to officially start, we need a quorum yet to do that, but we can start with the testimony, and today we are going to be hearing the cap and trade bill. Representative Knuth is here to present the bill, and this is an informational hearing, and we do have a number of people who are on the list to testify. So when we do start the testimony, if people could keep their remarks to 5 minutes or less, that would be very helpful in ensuring that everybody gets a chance to be heard. And try not to repeat what others have said before. If you're in agreement with what others have said, you can point that you agree with certain points that have been made, but don't have to go through all those points once again. And again, that would be helpful. With that, I'd like to start with Representative Smith, if you'd like to present the bill for us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're talking about House Bill 3195, which is the Green Solution Act. And as many of you probably remember, we passed historic legislation last year setting targets for greenhouse gas emissions reductions, global warming pollution reductions of 15% by 2015, 30% by 2025, and 80% by 2050. These are pretty substantial goals, and we actually had over 100 members voting for these goals, and the governor signed them into law. They're the goals that science tells us we need to avoid dangerous climate change, the actual reductions, not just the goals. We need the actual reductions. We also passed the Renewable Energy Standard and a very strong conservation and efficiency bill, which will help move us towards meeting these emission reductions goals. However, the reality is emissions are still going up, and they need to be going down. That's the kind of simple way of looking at this. They're going up, they need to go down, that's what matters. So this bill helps move us toward global warming pollution reductions by setting up a market framework to ensure that we actually reach the goals we've put into law. We want to ensure that the cap and trade program currently being negotiated by the Midwestern Governors Association is done in a way that helps us make the transition to a clean energy economy and make sure we can get the actual real reductions we need and have an effective and efficient program. So kind of the basics of a cap and trade program, it simply limits the amount of global warming pollution that we can emit. And then it allows emitters under this cap, as they call it, to buy and sell allowances to cover the emissions that they have. It's a pretty simple and powerful way to get real reductions by capping the amount of emissions we can have and then putting a real price on pollution, which up until this point we haven't had that market signal. I know we talked a lot about last year about the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. They actually did vote in favor of a cap and trade program. There's not all of the details are not in agreement, but they did vote to support a cap and trade program. And I actually have, if members of the committee are interested, who was on that cap and trade working group, so you can get a sense of who is actually making these votes and who the organizations they represent, because I think that's a pretty important part of this. Transparency of this process.
And we could probably have those passed out if you'd like to have the page pass them out to the members. That'd be good.
That'd be great. And if anyone else, I mean, lots of people around here were on this working group, but there's plenty of copies for others as well. So now going through the bill, there are some findings which you can read through and kind of basically saying we want to reach our goals, and the legislature finds that a cap and trade program is an effective way and a very important part of doing that. It then goes through some definitions and then goes into the cap and trade program itself. And it basically states that any cap and trade program adopted in Minnesota must meet certain principles. So the first principle of that is the sectors that it includes. It includes the electricity generation sector, large industrial facilities, transportation fuels, natural gas, sold to heat buildings and landfills. It would also include the commissioner, and this, the Commissioner of Commerce, could decide to include other sectors if it's determined that the reductions could be made more cost-effectively by being included in the cap, and that it's not unduly burdensome for the administration of the cap-and-trade program, and that the reductions can be measured and verified accurately. The next section, Section 3, Subdivision 3, states that all allowances issued under the cap and trade program would be auctioned, meaning that the emitters would have to buy the allowances instead of any sort of free distribution. The fourth section, or the fourth subdivision, restricts any reductions from outside the cap sectors. So basically the emitters are not allowed to meet the cap using reductions outside of cap sectors. Basically, and we want reductions outside of the cap, but we can get at this in other ways using some of the other mechanisms that we've got in the bill. And in addition, we already have stated the principle that any reduction or any sector where the reductions are measurable and verifiable would be included under the cap. Finally, Subdivision 5 prohibits any additional allowances being issued if the price of allowance, or if the price of allowance meets a certain price. It's basically saying the cap is firm. These are real reductions we expect to make in our economy. And it also states we would not enter into a trading relationship with any regional or any other jurisdiction that has issues extra allowances at a certain price point or any other point. And currently the Northeast does not issue additional allowances. They have some other mechanism when certain prices are reached. The next section, Section 4, recognizes the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Accord and encourages this process. I think the Climate Change Advisory Group, and I think the sense of the legislature, is that a Midwestern program is a better way to go than to go it alone, and I think more effective in cost in actual reductions and more cost effective. It also states that the model rule that the Midwestern Governors Association would come back with, and if members aren't already aware, the date that this model rule is supposed to be completed according to the Greenhouse Gas Accord is November 15th, 2008, so the end of this year. It's already working in the process. And then asking for a report from the Commissioner of Commerce and the Commissioner of PCA about this process and the movement towards a model rule, as well as other options if there's not movement towards this model rule that would allow Minnesota to meet its statutory goals. Section 5 establishes a trust fund. Because we're auctioning these allowances, we would expect some revenue to come into the state, so this establishes a special fund called the Climate Trust Fund. Section 6 states goals and uses of the Climate Trust Fund. Basically, we want to make this transition as cost-effective and smooth as possible, making sure we create jobs and have job growth and don't have any disruptive impacts, and making sure we're protecting the environment, public health, and other important environmental things. The Subdivision 2 states possible expenditures for use of this fund, and those include direct dividends to consumers, as well as grants and incentives to help consumers transition to more energy-efficient sources. It recognizes the need to help particular energy-intensive industries that may be subject to competition from from other places that don't have the same comparable regulation. Investments in infrastructure to reduce emissions, investments in worker training and retraining, because we expect to have different kinds of jobs in the new energy economy. And then also some support to study and implement terrestrial carbon sequestration through agricultural and forestry practices, mainly. And then the final part of the bill is two different studies. The first is actually a study of how to govern this fund. It could be a pretty significant amount of money, and so making sure we use that money to actually make this transition and make these decisions well will be really important, and so getting some more information about how to do that. The second study is how best to use the auction revenue in terms of promoting the transition of the economy and reducing emissions in the most cost-effective way possible, and referencing some of the work that's already been done by the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. So those are the basics of the bill, and I think we'll get into more details as we have a few of the testifiers. I just wanted to walk it through with the fact of what we're actually trying to accomplish with this bill. I think it establishes some really strong principles of cap and trade program that we need to move towards in the Midwestern region, and will provide us with some information as we move forward in this process. This is an ongoing process. It's already started. The governor will be coming back, I hope, if he's following his own greenhouse gas accord with a model rule, and the legislature will be expected to act on certain parts of that. And so it provides some of the strong principles that we need for an effective cap and trade program, and also provides some more of the information we need to make sure that we're doing this in the right way. So the first testifier we have is Deirdre Hamilton from Fresh Energy, and I'm going to turn it over to her.
Okay, thank you, Representative Knuth. And I'll officially call the meeting to order, and we do have minutes to approve as well. If somebody would like to move the minutes from February 14th to 19th, if you've had a chance to review them. President Scalzi moves the minutes for February 14th to 19th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Yes, and again, thanks for testifying, J. Drake Hamilton from Fresh Energy. Thanks for joining us. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
J. Drake Hamilton. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is J. Drake Hamilton, and I serve as Science Policy Director for Fresh Energy. I oversee at Fresh Energy our Global Warming Solutions Program, which is aimed at greatly reducing greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota and the Midwest in a way that builds economic development for the heartland of this country. Today, I'm also testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We decided to consolidate our testimony. The partnership is a coalition of aid, conservation groups, and environmental organizations throughout Minnesota who collectively believe the protection of our lakes, rivers, forests, land, and air is at the very core of protecting our future. Our members, all told, are about 500,000 Minnesotans in all districts. Each year, NEP's members choose a few issues they believe this year rise to the level of having the full force of the coalition behind their passage. NEP calls it collectively our collaborative or priority agenda. Our members have some criteria in mind when selecting an issue, the impact it will have on the great outdoors, whether or not there's broad public support for the issue, and the timing. Are we in a particular sweet spot where it just seems like it's time for this to be successful and for us to move legislation? The Green Solutions Act satisfies all of these criteria. The climate changes that are underway today are different from the natural weather patterns or climate cycles that we've all observed. The scientists are telling us that in 2007, the scientific community issued its defining assessment that the changes to our climate are now unequivocal, and that human actions are responsible for most of the climate change and global warming that we have been able to document to date. Not all of it, but most of it, and that's what we have responsibility for. The changes scientists project are happening more rapidly, much more rapidly, than the previous natural changes, and it is that pace of change that gives scientists great pause, and economists are paying attention as well as our businesses. The State Climatology Office here in Minnesota already has documented that Minnesota's climate is changing. Our winters really are getting warmer and shorter, particularly at night, although future warming is expected to happen in the summertime. We are seeing now something we never saw as recently as 15 years ago in Minnesota, which is tropical dewpoints in many towns in Minnesota on at least a few summer nights. So these are nights when the TV meteorologists will announce that if you're right, that it seems like you just can't get comfortable at night, you're right, because the dew point is higher tonight in Minnesota than it is in Bombay, India. And that is just not the way it used to be in Minnesota. We are also able to document that although precipitation annually hasn't really changed, more of our rainfall is coming as heavy downpours, as 1 and 2 inch rainfalls, which conveys significant flooding risk and stormwater management and problems for our aquatic resources. Minnesota scientists expect that global warming and climate change could further increase Minnesota's temperatures by another 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit this century. So we are expecting to see more impacts of global warming because of our continental location. We're not near the moderating influence of an ocean, just for the exact same physical reasons that we see extreme winters and extreme summers. All of the climate models predict that Minnesota sees more change in global warming than the global average. As we all know, just numbers for the amount of temperature and precipitation don't tell us anything about what the climate is like. It matters what the timing of this is like, and it changes everything in the climate. So the temperature changes, precipitation changes, will mean that we'll see a different Minnesota if we don't radically change our energy system. And this will have impact because this is the Environment Committee. Especially, we will see impacts on forests, on lakes, on fish, wildlife, and on cat populations. For Minnesota, more global warming will bring more drought, drier soils, less ice cover on our lakes, and lower lake levels. Rainfall will continue to come in less frequent but greater downpours. It used to be that scientists called these extreme weather events, and now some people are starting to look at that and call it what they really are, extensive weather events. With warmer temperatures, only the healthiest lakes will have the resilience to weather the changes from global warming. And we all know, certainly this committee knows well, there are many stresses on lakes. The icons of Minnesota's wildlife, moose, trout, loons, duck populations, even walleye in Lake Pepin, are already showing heat stress, at least partly due to global warming. If we lose those icons for Minnesota, they're just the first vulnerable part of our great outdoors. We are not really be able to call ourselves good stewards of Minnesota's future. These damages that are just beginning to be felt in Minnesota are caused by rising emissions of greenhouse gas emissions. So we need to do two things. We need to limit global warming emissions from major sources. We need to lower the emissions limit over time in order to achieve the goals that were set in the Next Generation Energy Act. And in doing so, we should employ a set of policies that rely on market forces to reduce the cost of achieving those reductions. What's happening with our emissions instead is that they're increasing. According to the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group's draft report and inventory, in 2005, Minnesota's global warming emissions amounted to about 155 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. So 155 million metric tons. Under business as usual, the Pollution Control Agency and the MCAG are projecting that will increase by about 12% by 2015 and by almost 28% by 2025. So the number 155 million metric tons would go to 173 million metric tons and then higher than 197 million metric tons. Exactly the opposite direction from what the law you supported last year directs us to do. So unfortunately, there's nothing now on the books that would actually limit greenhouse gas emissions, and existing laws will not be nearly enough to get us the reduction goals passed last year. Representative Knuth mentioned what those goals are, and essentially at a time where we know we need to cause emissions to level off and start to go down by 2015, instead we're heading in exactly the opposite direction. The law, the Next Generation Energy Act itself, did not include mechanisms for achieving those goals, but directed the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group multi-stakeholder planning process to help identify the mechanisms. While the MCAG process, as it's called, did not agree on all the specifics of a cap and trade program, it did recommend by majority vote on January 24th that Minnesota proceed with a regional cap and trade to help us meet Minnesota's goals more cheaply than if we didn't use those market mechanisms. The MCAG results identified the set of mechanisms to get us to the state's goal. In particular, MCAG has estimated, and these are still preliminary results, but the numbers I'm told will not change. The text is being written around those numbers. That by the year 2025, if the state were to enact all of the recommendations coming out of MCAG, we could get about a 50 million metric ton reduction in greenhouse gases by 2025. So we'd be right on schedule to meet those 30% reductions. But we'd have to implement all of those recommendations. MCAG further recommended that the state work with the Midwestern Governors Association partners to design and implement a multi-sector regional cap and trade system, which should be open to consideration of other non-cap and trade measures. So in other words, you don't just need the cap and trade market mechanism, you need other policies on top of that. And that this system should strive to be transparent, have full coverage across the economy, be as simple as possible, and be administratively efficient. This bill, the Green Solutions Act, keeps the ball rolling toward responsible emissions reductions by setting up a framework that allows the system to be formally authorized next session in 2009. The bill requires the creation of two studies that will help us determine in Minnesota how best to administer and spend the funds from a cap and trade and assist in Minnesota's transition to a greener economy that takes global warming seriously. It also establishes a few really important principles to ensure that as Governor Pawlenty goes about his negotiations as part of the Midwestern Governors Association initiative, as part of that regional cap and trade discussion that has already started, there are some guidelines to guide that process. On November 16th of last year, the governor, along with the governors of Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, and Michigan, the premier of Manitoba, signed the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Reduction Accord. These leaders are now in the process of creating a model rule due out on November 15th of this year. So the train has left the station, the region is moving toward a market system, and it would be wonderful to have Minnesota legislative leaders weigh in. The good news from the science is all that if we act swiftly, the most devastating economic impacts are not inevitable. We get to choose our future here. The Green Solutions Act is a simple and powerful vehicle that serves as a guiding document and outlines key principles for a market program success. We support 100% auction of global warming pollution allowances with revenues to be used to speed the transition to a lower carbon economy. By auctioning emissions allowances, we would let the market set the price for emissions instead of relying on the government to do so. The bill would not allow offsets outside of the cap system because that would weaken the limit, and that would mean the program could not reach the goals set in the Next Generation Energy Act. We urge you to pass this bill and move Minnesota closer to real and comprehensive global warming solutions. Thank you for demonstrating leadership in protecting Minnesota's future, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. And are there any questions at all for Ms. Hamilton before we move on to the next testifier? Okay, seeing none, we have next on the list Mr. Duke Bascom from Global Green Concepts. If you could state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, committee. My name is Duke Bascom. I'm the founder and CEO of Global Green Energy. Actually, the name as it appears on your list is not accurate. Global Green Energy, which I will refer to here otherwise as G2E, is a private investment firm solely dedicated to clean, efficient energy. Not clean technology, as you often hear, solely dedicated to clean, efficient energy. I founded Global Green Energy in California, where I lived for 11 years, in the year 2000. To say the least, the water cooler talk in 2000 was a little quieter than it is today about the various forces that are driving clean, efficient energy as a common solution. In addition, I recently served for 9 months as a member of the MCAG, which Jay addressed. I have no political affiliations here in the Twin Cities. Been here for 5 years, married the daughter of a fifth-generation farmer. I have no personal relationships with anybody who formulated the MCAG, and I was Global Green Energy was the only investment firm at the table. The definition of success for G2E is profitable environmental benefit through clean, efficient energy. It has to be profitable, and it has to provide environmental benefit. Can't have one or the other. You have to have both. In addition, for G2E to be successful, the greatest single immediate need is the external pricing of carbon or greenhouse gases. Effectively, pay as you play, which we have never done in the 70 some odd years that fossil fuels have been emerging through the presence of coal, oil, and natural gas. There are two, as you all well know, there are two mechanisms to externally price carbon, greenhouse gases. One is a carbon tax, and the other is a cap-and-trade regime or system. As I came to better understand in the MCAG, I was a member of the Energy Supply Committee, a member of the cross-cutting committee, and also a member of the cap and trade committee or subgroup. A carbon tax, when you kind of strip down all the differences, will give you certainty of price. It will not give you certainty of the amount of greenhouse gases to be reduced. Cap and trade, on the other hand, will give you certainty about the amount of greenhouse gases to be reduced, but leaves it up to the market to determine the price. Those are very important differences. If you feel like greenhouse gas, climate change, global warming is an imperative problem that is growing in velocity and perhaps needs to be resolved sooner rather than later. I personally believe that cap and trade has emerged in the last 3 years in lieu of a carbon tax, both for political reasons as well as for environmental reasons. Again, the primary benefit and certainty of a cap and trade system is to give you certainty of the amount of greenhouse gases to be reduced. The state of Minnesota has established some of the most clear and aggressive and progressive goals in the country. As the MCAG itself demonstrated, over 100 people meeting weekly, thousands of hours, I would guess, came forward with 44 or 45 specific policies, and the amount of spare capacity is very, very thin, which in business terms is to say there's no redundancy. I know in business if you'd have 10, 15, 20% spare redundancy to make sure that an execution or a delivery doesn't fail. In the instance of the MCAG plan, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that the spare capacity or redundancy is less than 5%. So here is a group of Minnesota people from the public and the private and the governmental sector who met and examined thoroughly, and that's what we came up with. That should suggest to you that it is extraordinarily complex and that it will take the actions of all sectors. With regards to today, I'd like to address cap and trade as part of this piece of legislation that you're bringing forward. I applaud the fact that you are taking action and that you are taking action now, because time is the enemy. A cap and trade system can provide the greatest value when it is most simply and clearly and transparently constructed. By that, I mean that offsets, safety valves, and anything which changes the economics, changes the supply and demand of the cap and trade system, will diminish the value. That's an imperative thing for you all to remember. I'd like to address 7 questions here today as I thought about what might come to your mind. First of all, what is cap and trade? And I'm going to, these first three, I'm going to take from the executive summary of the MCAG report, page 8.1. So the first question I'd like to address is, what is cap and trade? It is a system by which the sources within covered sectors find and achieve the lowest cost emissions reduction investment. So what government is doing is establishing the standards, and what the market is doing is finding the lowest cost solution. Second question, what is the beauty of cap and trade? Again, page 8.1. Since the government regulates only the total emissions, the means by which the reductions are achieved is left to the individual covered sources. Much like the renewable portfolio standard, Government sets the standard in the best public interest, and the market responds in the best way it knows possible. Question number three, again from page 8.1. How is value in a cap-and-trade system realized? Through trading, participants with lower costs of compliance can choose to over-comply and sell their additional reductions to participants for whom compliance costs are higher. In this fashion, the overall cost of compliance are lower than would otherwise be the case. The counterintuitive characteristic about cap and trade is that it is a lower cost for both sellers and buyers of credit. I'd like you to kind of make a special note of that one, because it took me a while. I'm not the smartest camper, but it took me a while to understand how both a buyer and a seller could realize savings in a cap-and-trade system. Question number four. Why is the Midwestern governor's cap-and-trade regime important? Number one, it creates a larger marketplace that has more trading options, more buyers, more sellers. Therefore, it provides greater robust trading activity. Not that markets are perfect and not that markets are always efficient, but the larger the market, it is commonly held, the larger the market, the greater the benefit to the participants. In every one of the cost curves that we analyze, when you looked at Minnesota by itself, it came up realizing less benefit, i.e. greater cost, than if it was part of a broader set of trading partners. Point number two, as part of a larger universe, the Midwest will have a greater voice when it comes to the formulation of a federal cap-and-trade system. And that is a critical issue, because if you were a betting person, you would bet that by 2010, whether you have a Republican or a Democratic presidential administration, you're going to see a cap-and-trade system in this country. Now, it's going to take 3 or 4 years to organize and ramp up and really get off the tarmac. But the reality is that it is in Europe, and major corporations for the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, starting 2 years ago, are saying to the federal government, we're global business providers, we need to get a cap-and-trade system here. Now, specifically with regards to your Bill 3195, consistent with the MCAG, I wholeheartedly support the sectors that have been identified. Secondly, the auction is probably the next most important feature that will have to be addressed, and it's a very complicated one, because many constituents in business will ask you to allocate for free. And I think we all know that if something of value doesn't have a price, it eventually will have less value. That's a fairly simple and well-accepted principle of economics. Some call it free lunch. But the fact of the matter is that in an allocation system, you're giving a free asset to the recipient, to the business, to the generator of that associated with that credit. Free asset. It's got a market value. In an auction system, you are giving the funds, so to speak, to the government. That is a whole can of worms in a lot of people's minds in and of itself, which is why I think your climate trust fund is not only an excellent idea, but it is very timely. Because to establish the operating principles for that climate trust fund now before you get into multi-state, before you get into national, means that you're going to go through the debate of what is best for the state of Minnesota. And everybody has got to weigh in on that because everybody's got to have ownership. Governor, House, Senate, agencies, private sector, everybody has got to have a seat at the table because everybody is impacted by it. So I would wholeheartedly endorse an auction because that is the best way to get to the clearest price signal to change the behavior that needs to be changed. The two studies that you suggest, which are for governance and the economics, associated with a cap and trade, I think are an excellent idea because they take the discussion that began at the MCAG and they continue it focused on very specific considerations. Again, if you remember the principle that time is the enemy, because this is so complex and has so much daunting change, it's imperative to keep the action moving. Number six that I'd like to address is what I feel are some added considerations that either could be addressed in this bill or might be addressed immediately someplace else. I think the concept of registering emissions so that you can monitor emissions and so that you can report on emissions is imperative to get done as soon as possible. Because you don't want to, once a cap and trade system is in place, then have to go back and say, well, we don't really know how, we don't have them registered yet, we don't know how to monitor them yet, we don't know how to report on them, so we have to take more time. Secondly, I think it would be very beneficial to recognize, provide incentives for early action, early greenhouse gas reduction action. And in that regard, to create some mechanism to monetize those early action reductions. Give people the carrot at the same time that you're providing the regulations to reduce these greenhouse gases. Finally, the question is, can you afford to do nothing and wait until the Midwestern initiative is put together or until the federal initiative is put together? I personally don't believe that you can. There are so many decisions that have to be made that impact, that come from and impact so many different constituents, you cannot fail to wait. You cannot wait and lose time. 80% of all energy that is used globally is fossil fuel. Based on the Department of Energy and the International Energy Agency, in 2030, 80% of fuel of our energy globally will be fossil fuel. So I'd like to leave you with 3 points. First, it's imperative to take action. Secondly, get started immediately with the action that you take. And thirdly, think as boldly and as long-term as you possibly can. This is not a small problem. Incremental solutions and compartmentalized discussions will not get us there. It's a holistic problem that needs a holistic solution. It's wonderful that you all are taking this up. I hope that you'll get it done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bascom. One question about on the MCAG. I know that there was a recommendation for a cap and trade. Did they reject the carbon tax for the reason that you had mentioned, that because there's a lack of certainty involved with that? Or I was just wondering if you could just...
There's any question. We discussed carbon tax. But I don't think we deeply analyzed it. The analysis is actually, in terms of the math, the numbers, is actually the same as cap and trade. Again, you end up with different priorities, different outcomes, or different qualities, if you will. I think implicitly, I don't care who you are or where you are, I think everybody kind of implicitly thinks that cap and trade is politically more viable and therefore able to become reality far sooner rather than later. I think the concept of a carbon tax politically is a very difficult and very divisive consideration.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bascom. Any other questions before we move on?
Thank you very much.
None. Next, we have Dr. Steve Pulaski from the University of Minnesota. And again, if I could remind testifiers to try to keep it to 5 minutes or less, since we do have a number of people on the agenda, that would be very helpful. So, thank you. Dr. Pulaski, if you could state your name, please.
My name is Steve Pulaski. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. I have a degree in economics, and at the university, I have a joint position between applied economics and ecology, evolution, and behavior. I was also, like Duke and Jay, also on the MCAG, serving on the Cap and Trade Committee and the Energy Supply Technical Working Group. I was here about 3 weeks ago doing I called it a Cap and Trade 101, and there I had about half an hour, but I realized 5 minutes, I will go quickly and talk only about a few points. The basic idea of cap and trade is really quite simple, as it has been stated, and it's a very powerful idea, because what you're doing is you're harnessing market forces to get to an environmental goal. So the cap is a limit on the number of on the amount of emissions, in this case of greenhouse gases. So there's your environmental goal. How strict you set the cap is how how ambitious you are in the environmental objective. The trade part is where the market forces come in, where the economic efficiency comes in. So allowing emission sources to trade allows flexibility. So we're not telling emission sources exactly how they have to reduce emissions. Just here's the goal. You figure out the best way to do it. They can trade amongst themselves. So it's market-oriented, and it gets to the least cost way of achieving the economic goal. So you're marrying the environmental aspects of this with the economic efficiency aspects of this, achieving an environmental goal in the least cost manner. Cap and trade has actually been used in policy on a number of different areas. This is an idea coming out of economics from the late 1960s, but was put into practice at a large scale in the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments. So sulfur dioxide trading was put in nationwide, EPA monitoring this program, reducing SO2 emissions by roughly 50%. It's now been expanded to nitrogen oxide trading. It's interesting in Minnesota, the Minnesota River, cap and trade, a limited cap and trade policy for water pollution. Also in Europe right now, there is the European Union emissions trading system. More locally, there's a Chicago Climate Exchange, of which a number of parties, including the University of Minnesota, are partaking in it. So there are examples of cap and trade existing, both for carbon, for greenhouse gas emissions, and also in other areas in the environment. Again, it's a simple idea, but there are, in fact, many details. So I think, as Duke said, I think moving early and getting going and paying careful and close attention to getting the details right will make a lot of difference in seeing the promise of this of a cap and trade. So keeping it simple, keeping it clear, transparent, that will allow you to achieve this achieve the goals in the least cost manner. I want to talk about three very specific aspects of a cap and trade. Some of these are controversial, and while the MCAG was very clear in endorsing cap and trade. The first aspect that I'm going to talk about, which is the initial allocation. So how do you give out the allowances to the parties that need them, to the people who are going to be emitting? There are two common ways of doing this. One is an auction. As was mentioned before, the other ways to hand them out are called grandfathering, and typically this is done on the basis of past emissions. Most economists favor auctioning. They do this for a couple of reasons. One is it treats all sources fairly, so even if I have not had a past record of emissions, I have the same ability to get into the market as everybody else. And the second is what's called the polluter pays principle. So, as Duke said, we're really creating a valuable asset here from something that had not been previously an asset or traded. The polluter pays principle, I mean, the reason why we're doing this is for the environmental objective. There really is a cost associated with emissions, and this market is making that cost more transparent. If you hand these out for free, in a sense, you're rewarding the person who's doing the emissions. The polluter pays principle says those who are creating the cost, in this case creating the emissions, should pay for it. And that's what an auction does. Now, the politics of this are this is where there's a question, and there's also one, because the politics of this is, there are different distributional consequences of going for an auction or handing these out for free. The other thing that I would just mention here, there is a question of, you know, you are creating something which has a price once you go with a cap and trade system for something that had been free previously. So there are questions of transition and sort of how fast you go to a complete auction versus grandfathering. But anyway, that's auctioning, or how you hand out the emissions allowances in the first place, is one important concept. Another important area to focus on is the question of being able to monitor and enforce. And here there are two principles. One is there has to be a clear way to monitor what the emissions actually are. So I'll contrast fossil fuel use, which for the most part is relatively straightforward to monitor, versus say land use practices or land use changes, which are more difficult. On monitoring and enforcement, you want to have, again, it's got to be easy to monitor, it has to be transparent, and you also, the second principle here is, if you want to do this in a way which has the least administrative burden. I mean, part of the advantage of a cap and trade system is that you achieve the environmental goal in the least cost manner. Realizing the gains of a cap and trade means that it has to be, you know, you want to do this in a way that is administratively easy. So, for example, rather than putting the burden at the end user, hundreds of thousands of households, you would want to do this upstream where there are only a few sources that would actually be able to keep the records and keep them fairly cleanly. The third and last issue that I want to mention here is on sectoral coverage, sort of what's inside of a cap and trade and what's outside of the cap and trade system. Again, the general principle here that I'd like to enunciate is that one would like to have as broad as coverage as possible so that you get kind of the whole economy on the same footing. The only exception to that broad coverage is the second point that I just made about enforcement and monitoring. So in order to be under the cap and trade, one really has to be able to monitor the emissions fairly clearly. So, I think where you draw the line in terms of sector coverage, again, I would emphasize broad coverage as much as possible, tempered by the reality of where can you actually effectively measure and monitor emissions. And related to this, well, what about those sectors which are outside of a cap and trade? Should you have early action credits or offsets? Part of what Duke had talked about before of having sort of a very simple and transparent system, if you have lots of offsets, and offsets here mean that if a sector is outside of the cap and trade, can they get credit? So can somebody inside of the cap and trade get credit for trading with somebody who's outside, who's done some action which may reduce emissions? If not done correctly, that could weaken the cap and trade. You're basically getting more allowances, in a sense, into the system. And also you have to be very careful about, is it a real offset? Is it a real emissions reduction? So there are lots of details that have to be gotten correct in a cap and trade system for it to realize its potential. But I want to return to the main point, which is it is in fact a very simple and powerful idea that does harness market forces for an environmental objective. So with that, I will stop.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Pulaski. Any questions at all for Dr. Pulaski? Seeing none, thanks again. And next on our agenda, we have Reverend Mark Peters from the Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. Reverend Peters, welcome, and you can state your name for the record, please.
Representative Eakin and members of the committee, my name is Mark Peters. I'm Executive Director of Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. Have been with that office for 13 years now, and our office is directly across the street at Christ Lutheran Church. Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy has been around for over 20 years, and we're a partnership ministry of the six Minnesota synods of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. About 1,200 congregations statewide of the ELCA and about 800,000 baptized members. I'm here today to speak in favor of and urge favorable vote for the Green Solutions Act of 2008, and also to say a word of thanks for the historic action that took place last year. It's just a profound impact I'm hearing as I travel about the state from congregations and from creation care teams expressing such a favorable opinion of what the legislature did last year. Global warming is a religious and a moral issue, and the U.S. makes up only about 4% of the world's population but contributes to 25% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. This statistic is especially important because global warming is already having a disproportionate negative impact on those least able to do anything about it. We are called to care for all of God's children, especially the most vulnerable, and we have a unique role to play to protect and restore God's creation. The ELCA social statement, Caring for Creation, it was passed in 1993, and it actually back then identifies global warming as a major concern. It has some very good things to say about vision, hope, and justice. This was approved at the National Assembly for the Lutheran Church. It says, human behavior may change through economic incentives, guilt about the past, or fear about the future. But as people of biblical faith who live together in trust and hope, our primary motivation is the call to be God's caregivers and to do justice. Well, last year when I testified before this committee, and Bishop Craig Johnson also testified here, I said that over half the phone calls to our office were regarding this issue. The phone has been ringing off the hook. I'm grateful to say that Ingrid Vick, who is a creation care coordinator for our office statewide, a recent Gustavus grad, has been very engaged in this issue around the state. We've had 10 interns in the last year, many of them from St. Olaf and the Humphrey Institute and other places. They've all had a passionate interest in this issue, and hunger. That's the other, hunger and poverty, those issues we work on also. And I think it demonstrates to me that if you build it, they will come. And what I mean by that is there has been such a turnout. I will have a few things to hand out at the end here for every one of you here. But Polar Explorer Will Seeger has very generously donated his time to speak at these forums across the state that we co-sponsor. I'll speak most specifically to 9 of them. Get this paper clip out of the way here. Let me just tell you where they were and who came. In New Ulm, we had one in August, right around the Farm Fest. We had 450 people. Bishop John Anderson from Southwest Synod spoke. In Lakeville, we had 600 people. That was in a Catholic church. In Duluth, we had 500 people. Bishop Peter Strumman addressed that group. In Sauk Rapids, we had 550 people. Bishop Kinney and Bishop John Anderson had a statement to read at that event. Albert Lee, 200 people. Bishop Harold Uzgard from Southeast Synod spoke at that event. Rochester, 900 people. Mankato, we had 350 people. And in Moorhead, we had over 1,000 people to Concordia College. And the new bishop, Larry Wilrabi, spoke at that event. He called it a wake-up call in an email to me the next day. That's the response we've been having. Bishop John Anderson has served on the MCAG over the last year. And he speaks of a profound transformation in regard to this issue. He's had piles of stuff to read through. We also had the Fall Ministerium for Minneapolis Area Synod, which is the largest Lutheran synod in the United States. Close to 170 congregations for all the rostered leaders, the clergy in that synod. Bishop Craig Johnson spoke at that, and Will Seeger spoke as well. During the 17-month period before, to give you a sense of the ramp-up, we did another 9 events with Will Seeger. Average attendance was 440 people, but we had over 1,000 in Matamidi at a Lutheran church and at Eden Prairie at a Lutheran church. Again, the turnout and the phone calls for these have been phenomenal statewide, and I can't emphasize that enough. And so in conclusion, how many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb? Change? You can change all the light bulbs you want, but Lutherans are starting to get that you need more than changing light bulbs and energy audits and recycling and all of the things that they're doing in their congregations and in their personal lives and in their business lives to make a difference. They need policy change. Last year, the legislature responded. People of faith are making the connection between their faith and action. All the Minnesota bishops are very engaged in the synod. I want to conclude with a statement from the Lutheran Social Statement here. It's a quote from Martin Luther. And he was asked what he would do if he knew that the world would end tomorrow. And he reportedly answered that I would plant an apple tree today. And this statement concludes, when we face today's crisis, we do not despair, we act. And I'd like to thank you all for the action you have taken, that the Lutheran Church is seeking to be a credible and authentic voice in this as we do our part at the congregational level, but we look to the legislature to weigh in with principles to guide this process as it moves forward and support the Green Solutions Act for 2008. I have a few handouts I'll pass out, including a couple of synodical resolutions that passed unanimously at the St. Paul and Minneapolis Area Synod Assembly. Thank you very much.
Okay. And thank you, Reverend Peters, and if the pages want to help pass those around, that'd be great. Any questions at all? Okay. Seeing none, the next testifiers will be in opposition to the bill that we are having a hearing on. First, we have Edward Garvey, Minnesota Office of Energy Security. Yes, Representative Cornish.
I would be interested in what's going to happen to all us Christians that think this is a little bit hyped up. We just want to slow the train down if we're headed for destruction or what the Catholics think and a number of other questions.
I don't know if you have anybody here representing the Catholics. You can maybe testify later. Mr. Garvey, welcome to the committee. And thank you for joining us. You can state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Edward Garvey. I'm the director of the Office of Energy Security and a deputy commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. In this capacity, I've been a point person for Governor Plenty on his energy issues since 2003. I was also one of the primary negotiators of the Midwestern Governors Association on behalf of Governor Plenty. So I want to give some thoughts to the committee on the bill that's before you. I was, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, going to walk through the summit platform and its four tiers, with this handout that you have. I believe this has been passed out in your packet, but for purposes of time, I think I won't do that, and I certainly can answer questions and go back to that if you want.
Okay,
but suffice it to say, the accord that the Midwestern governors reached last November was a very, very significant four-tier set of agreements. We spent a lot of time working through a lot of materials. Many of the materials that are in the both the accord itself, but also the components of the summit agreement, come from the actions that Minnesota has taken. We have the tiers, and not every governor signed on to every tier. Every governor signed on to the preamble, tier one. Fewer signed on to tier two, which is a set of aspirational goals and commitments to try to work towards those goals, energy efficiency, biofuel, those kind of things. Tier three is a set of regional cooperative agreements, and tier four is the greenhouse gas accord. You have a copy, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, of that accord before you. And in any respect, this is what we're now in the process of implementing that, and it is actually part of what the legislation that that's for you that you're discussing. Governor Pawlenty, in the State of the State last week, said that we should take further action, further steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but it is important that our efforts ensure jobs are not lost as a result and that Minnesota does not place itself at a competitive disadvantage. In that, those two sentences, Mr. Chairman, you have the governor's commitment to move forward to address greenhouse gas emissions, but to do it in a way that is not disadvantageous to the state of Minnesota, but in fact advantageous. Good. So, Mr. Chairman, I think what we have is a very common set of goals, a goal that the state should address its greenhouse gas emissions. It should do so in a thoughtful, deliberative way that maximizes our economic benefits while minimizing our adverse and unintended consequences. From our point of view, we need to do that in three ways. We need to implement the existing actions, the actions that we put underway less than a year ago with the adoption of the renewable energy standard and the components in the Next Generation Energy Act. We must implement those in order to achieve our goals. Second, we need and we should be thinking about and pursuing additional deliberative, thoughtful, and incremental ways to go beyond those actions to address our greenhouse gas emissions. The MCAG, as you've heard about, has already discussed some of those options. The governor and I put together a plan that's before the legislature on other ways, thoughtful, deliberative, incremental ways. The third way is to pursue a regional and hopefully a national approach to greenhouse gas emissions. It is the third way that's before the commission, before this committee, but I want to make sure we're clear that there are other paths that we can and should be pursuing in order that we address greenhouse gas emissions. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's not a question of whether or not we have common goals. We do. Common goals of addressing greenhouse gas emissions, doing it in a thoughtful way, we're on that path as a state. The concern that I want to register with the committee is how we go about that, particularly in the context of the Midwest Governors Association and the negotiations that are going to have to be undertaken to achieve an accord with the other states. You've heard testimony on cap and trade. We agree that that is the approach that we should take. The accord itself talks about a multi-sectoral approach. Those are two very important overarching rubrics. You've heard also that it's a very complicated set of underlying details to implement those two components. My message to the committee is to allow us the maximum amount of flexibility in order to negotiate with our sister states to achieve an accord that can address greenhouse gas emissions in the state, in the region, that will be hopefully reflected at the federal level. And that now is not the time to adopt legislation that would constrain our ability to achieve those negotiations. I want to also point out to this committee that we have a very strong record of achieving high-level consensus that's stakeholder-driven, that makes significant steps forward, that's bipartisan. I'll point out the agreement with on the Metropolitan Emissions Reduction Program, mercury, renewable energy standards, the Next Generation Energy Act itself, the accord that is before you. These were all achieved with a stakeholder-driven process at a high level with consensus and agreement and significant steps forward. So when I come to you and I sort of say that I'm asking for the ability of maximum flexibility, I'm not saying that we can't achieve something. I'm saying we can, we have, and we will. Components of the bill, I think, will not help us do that. There are components of the bill that I think are very helpful. I'm mentioning specifically the studies on page, the report section 4, subdivision 4, section C, where we report on our progress in November. I hope to be able to report to you that we've achieved success on the model rule, because that is the timetable on when we have set out for ourselves. But I think it's important, and I'm willing to commit that we will do such a report. I think it is also important that on line 5.17, the emissions and economic study be done. I think we need to be mindful that such a study has the potential of being expensive, but I think that's an important study. So, Mr. Chairman, to conclude, we have common goals. We're having our concern, our reservations with the proposed legislation before you, is the enactment of constraints that may inhibit our ability to actually achieve the high-level consensus with the other states the way we've done it in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Garvey. And Representative Mull has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Garvey, I've heard the governor talk about his support for a cap-and-trade approach, and I know that you're involved in negotiations to create a regional system. I think a lot of us are glad for that. I'm going to remind you of things that I'm sure you already know. The state of Minnesota has been a leader on the environmental front in many ways. Mercury legislation that the governor signed that drove the national discussion, renewable energy standard here again, passed in the state of Minnesota, that's been driving the national discussion with our senators. I guess I'm not clear as to how this legislation, if passed, would constrain your ability to negotiate with the other surrounding states for a Midwestern pact. I guess as I understand it, and I'm no expert on this, but it seems to me, especially with the fairly aggressive approach here, 100% auction would, if we had some flexibility within the structure of the region, would be advantageous for other states to join in a compact with us and not a disincentive. So I guess maybe you could explain that. And then specifically, you didn't say what parts of the bill that you said the ones the governor likes, but you didn't say what parts the governor doesn't like. And so maybe you could be a little more clear on that, too.
Mr. Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, members of the committee, the goal that we are trying to seek with our state, and I believe the goal that the bill's author and that I think those of you in the committee who are thinking about this want, is a consensus, a high-level consensus that reduces greenhouse gas emissions among the states. The question that we're trying to struggle with is, I don't know what that high level is yet. I'll know in 6 months, I hope. We'll certainly be able to report to you by the end of this year, because that's the time frame that we're on. The proposal for a 100% front end, all sectors, may not be acceptable to other states. There may be other options that they want to pursue. The question that I have is, if this is enacted into law, does that prohibit me? Does that prohibit Minnesota from joining a alternative level? My concern is that it would. So therefore, the best course of action, my message is, have us do the study, have us do a report back. If you don't like what we want, what we've done, the legislature can always act at that point.
Representative Mull.
Thank you, Mr. Garvey. I guess a comment and then a question maybe for the author. I don't see a better way for us to give a signal to the surrounding states that we're serious in the state of Minnesota to support this approach other than passing legislation. I think that's a pretty significant commitment on our part, whether we pass this exactly as it is or perhaps amend it a bit. Representative Knuth, does it say anywhere in your bill that if this passes that we cannot continue negotiations with some flexibility with surrounding states to join in a compact, and then could maybe amend this later on to reflect those negotiations? I missed that, if it says that in there somewhere.
Thank you, Representative Mr. Chair and Representative Moe. It states that Minnesota would have these principles in a cap and trade that we adopted. It doesn't state anything about the negotiations. I actually think it sends a pretty strong signal to where we'd like to move in Minnesota in the negotiations, and it allows the legislature to have, as elected leaders in this state and not appointed people working through the process, and I think there's roles for both, but I think as elected leaders in this state, it's important to take that stand. We say all the time we don't constrain the hands of future legislatures, but I think this gives our governor a strong, differ with Mr. Garvey on saying how this would affect the negotiations. I think the negotiations could be different. We then reassess as the legislature next year of how we approach that. And many of these, it doesn't have to be the same in every state. For example, in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast, the model rule had a 25% minimum option in their distribution of allowances. Most states have now said that they want 100% auction, and the states have made those decisions individually. But there was a minimum part within the model rule. So we'll have a new legislator, and we'll be looking at this again. I would hope if we come back with a model rule that we work to enact what we need to enact in that. And so it doesn't say this is the only thing the governor can negotiate with. It says this is what we would like to see in Minnesota.
Representative Borgini.
Thank you. I don't even know what your title is anymore. It's so long.
Director.
Okay. Director Garvey. You're proposing for us a slow-down approach. Is something that Minnesotans are telling us is very urgent. Why should we be telling Minnesotans we should slow down at this point?
Mr. Garvey?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Levine. Not to disagree with you, but disagree with you We are not, and my message is not, that we're advocating a slowdown. In fact, last November, Governor Plenty and five other governors and the Premier of Manitoba signed an agreement that has us producing a model rule within 12 months. 18 months beyond that, we see its implementation. It's a very fast timetable. It's significantly faster than the other regions of the country that have a, that are in the process, that have or are in the process of adopting. What I'm asking the committee to do is not to constrain those negotiations, to allow us to achieve the highest level of compromise with our sister states that's appropriate and possible. It's not a slowdown. It's the avoidance of having us constrained until we can't achieve a high-level compromise.
Representative Virginia, follow-up.
Well, the slowdown words were yours, not mine. So, as I am listening to your new plan, I am reminded of your old plan, which was brought to us last year. We were going to have the MCAD group, and that was going to be the true path to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But the MCAD process pretty much fizzled out, and we don't see any results that we can get Minnesotans. So I think it's appropriate of us to wonder if this thing won't fizzle out too without some really strong push from the legislature. Because it was a strong push from the legislature that gave us the renewable energy standard. So I am very worried on behalf of Minnesotans right now.
Mr. Garvey?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative, I don't remember using the word slowdown, and if I did, I certainly didn't put it in the context of slowing down our efforts to address greenhouse gas emissions. The governor is committed to do it. He's charged me and my colleagues to move forward in that direction. And our goal is to implement the Midwest Governors Association before. I'll also suggest that the MCAG process has not fizzled out. Rather, it is in the process of being finalized. It has provided extraordinary amounts of valuable information on a whole host of issues that in many respects doesn't bring out the proverbial sort of silver bullet, but puts together a whole host of actions that we, as a state, as a people, as communities, as policymakers, are in the process of working through to implement. Some take time, some don't. But that's the way we're going to have to address this ubiquitous problem of greenhouse gas emissions and climate change.
Okay. Thank you, Director Garvey. And Representative Beinart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just tell me in a sentence or two what you see as the appropriate role of the legislature in this process, other than waiting?
Director Garvey.
I have to make sure I think of the sentence. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Biden, the legislature has a very important role as the ultimate lawmaker, lawmakers for the state. In this setting, having these hearings, sending the message, showing your interest, is very valuable. having legislation being discussed like this, offering that as guidance, is helpful. The audience hears it. We hear it. You think to send your message. Enacting it into law, prospectively, when negotiations are going to be started, is where things start getting troublesome right now.
Thank you, Director Garvey. Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Well, maybe a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair. Director Garvey, what about the legislature taking action that our state was contingent on the neighboring states taking action too? In other words, the idea this is good and you're saying you don't want to be an island, which I completely agree with. I think there's some impact here. We've got some competitors and we seem to keep doing things that want to hurt us and help Wisconsin or North Dakota. What if we took action that said we're going to take effect after other states take effect? Would that help move the process forward?
Director Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative McNamara, the whole reason we're having this discussion, and we view it being handled on a regional basis, is to make sure that Minnesota is not put at a disadvantage. We think that regional approaches, national approaches, is a superior way to handle this, and for certainly in a cap and trade approach, than a go it alone state approach. So, Mr. Chairman, our agreement is the proposal that of the Midwest governors is that we do want to achieve a high level of commonality for that very reason.
Thank you. And I think there's two more questions, and then I
can ask the author real quick. Representative Knuth, do you like the idea that if we move your legislation forward, contingent on the surrounding states adopting it?
Director Garvey.
Or were you asking me?
No, I was asking you.
Okay.
I already got his answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara. I think if we said it, if we put it on the other state adopting these principles as well, we would be constraining Mr. Garvey's negotiations, because there are parts of this that can be different between states. We could come back if we're unable to negotiate something as strong as this, and I trust there'll be a good faith effort should this become law to negotiate to this standard, and perhaps it's more of an effort, and I would hope more of an effort. But if we say it would only happen if other states adopted it, we've pretty much said the negotiation here. So I'm not comfortable with that. But I also do want to add that I think Minnesota enacting certain things to law has very positively influenced the Governors Association negotiations. And some of you may be on the Energy Committee, but I think Mike Bull's exact words were Minnesota set the floor in terms of our renewable electricity standards and our conservation and efficiency in the negotiations. People saw what we were able to do here, and other states came on board. And I think that's something we should be really proud of in the state of Minnesota, and something I'm trying to achieve with this legislation as well.
Thank you. And one more question. Representative Moe.
Not a question, Mr. Chairman, just a quick comment. I don't know if it would be very helpful for Minnesota to wait for environmental leadership from North Dakota. I think that might slow our progress a bit.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Director Garvey. And next, we do have still 13 more people on the list, and this is all in opposition. So, again, if you could watch the time, try to keep it to 5 minutes, and if others have said the same thing that you want to say, just point out that you agree, but don't go through all the points again. So that would be helpful. Next, we do have Mr. Michael Robertson from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Welcome, Mr. Robertson, and if you could state your name, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Robertson. I'm an environmental policy consultant to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And before I address the specific provisions of House File 3195, I'd like to provide the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce perspective on where Minnesota stands today on the road to achieve the greenhouse gas reduction goals that you established in the Next Generation Energy Act. I had the honor to serve with many of the people you've already heard this evening to serve as Minnesota Chamber's representative on the Climate Change Advisory Group, which, as you've already heard, is completing its report, and I wanted you to see what it looked like. This is a copy of the draft report. I spent the weekend going over the report. More than 100 people put in many long hours to complete a process that took half the time that it has taken other states to complete the process. And as I will describe in more detail in a moment, the MCAG report is not the end-all and be-all prescription for ensuring the 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, but it was a good start, and here is what we accomplished. First, we reviewed more than 300 options to reduce emissions, and we more specifically analyzed more than 50 options. And the bottom line, the MCAG recommendations will achieve the 2015 goal and fall just short of meeting the 2025 goal, and will put the state on a trajectory to achieve a 50% reduction by 2050. Second, the MCAG report concludes that the legislature has already adopted the options that have the highest reduction potential to reduce greenhouse gases. Take a look at the graph on the first page of my handout. The reductions that you set in motion last year, the renewable energy standard, and the 1.5% efficiency goal are by far the highest reduction options examined by the MCAG. Now, I said that the MCAG report was not the be-all, end-all prescription to achieve the 80% reduction. Because of time and lack of precision in projecting forward nearly more than four decades, we concentrated on the 2025 goal. Another shortcoming was our inability to flesh out all of the options or fully analyze the cost impact on consumers. And I refer you to my handout and the first page of the January 23rd memo that I wrote to my fellow MCAG members. Many of the proposals lack specificity on implementation mechanisms. More analysis of the cost to consumers and businesses is needed. The analysis only provides a broad assessment of societal costs. We did not answer the question, cost to whom? The competitive impact on specific business sectors and the cost to end-use consumers was not assessed. In addition, there was no accounting of governmental costs. Many of the proposals require governmental funding for implementation, but the cost to the taxpayers is not assessed. The overarching option, intended as the framework for achieving the aggressive statutory goals, is the cap-and-trade system. And I refer you to the chamber position on page 2 of my January 23rd memo. We believe that a cap-and-trade system is best implemented at the federal level. However, until legislation is passed in Washington, we will participate, as recommended by MCAG, in the development of a regional cap-and-trade system as part of the Midwest Governor's Greenhouse Gas Accord. In our view, no further legislation is necessary to move to the next stage in developing a regional cap-and-trade system. The law you passed last year includes Section 216H.02, Subdivision 6, which says, and I quote, "The state must, to the extent possible, work with other states in the Midwest region, develop and implement a regional approach to reducing greenhouse gas emissions from activities in the region, including consulting on a regional cap-and-trade system," end quote. Just 6 months after you enacted that sentence, the Midwest governors signed an agreement to do just that. And now the difficult task begins to develop the details of the regional system. Which brings me to House File 3195. We opposed the bill
because it prematurely establishes a state policy that emission allowances should be distributed through an auction. There was no consensus on this issue in the MCAG process. The draft report on in Chapter 8, page 7, notes that several methods are available for allowance distribution and recommends further study of five alternatives: partial auction and partial free distribution, a shift to an auction over time, an auction for unregulated entities, a sector-specific distribution system, and a performance-based market system. Now, the MCAG consultant's modeling of cap-and-trade options included an estimate of auctioning the allowances in a Midwest regional cap-and-trade. We actually have some numbers as to what this auction might look like and what the impact might be. And I'd ask you to turn to the final page of my handout, which is page 48 of Appendix K of the draft MCAG report. If table A17 shows that auctioning the allowances at a projected price of $45.95 per ton would raise $5.09 billion for the state in the year 2025. This is after emissions have been reduced by that 30% goal from the 2005 levels. And assuming that allowances are auctioned at the beginning of a cap-and-trade program, when most of that 30% of emissions have not been reduced, the revenue to the state would be much higher than $5 billion. For example, if, say, half of the reductions occurred up to the year 2015, and if you said that the auction price in 2015 might be $35 per ton, the revenue to the state would be $9.1 billion. Now, without a doubt, the auctioning of allowances is a multi-billion dollar revenue enhancer for the state treasury. In effect, an auction is equivalent to a carbon tax. You heard a lot of testimony earlier. You had the joint hearing where you got testimony about auction versus cap and trade. And I think the people that spoke at that time said that an auction is the equivalent of combining a cap and trade program with a carbon tax. An auction is not necessary to make a cap and trade system work. The cap on emissions will be enforced through law. Emitters will have to pay the cost to reduce emissions below the cap or buy allowances in the market if that is cheaper. An auction eliminates trading. Paying the auction price for all emissions will add an additional cost well beyond the cost to achieve the emission reduction under the cap. Now, the proponents of the auction say that it is needed to, as the bill says, quote, reduce disruptive economic impact of the transition on workers, businesses, and consumers, end quote. We appreciate the recognition that there will be disruptive economic impact on workers, businesses, and consumers. We support the economic study required in Section 6, Subdivision 4 of the bill, which requires estimates of increases in energy prices and the impact of such price increases on businesses and family income, and an analysis of ways to avoid putting Minnesota industries subject to the cap and trade at a competitive disadvantage. This is the economic analysis that I said earlier is needed, but is not included in the MCAG report. We need such an analysis, but the bill turns the policy decision on its head. The economic study should come first. And as recommended by MCAG, options relating to auctioning of allowances must be evaluated with our new stakeholder partners in the Midwest state. House File 3195 makes a huge revenue policy decision without any economic analysis, without any discussion with Midwest partners who will be integral to implementing that revenue decision, to impose a multi-billion dollar cost, which has not been fully evaluated, or cost on consumers to reduce the impact of another policy decision, cap and trade, which has not been fully evaluated for its economic impact. This is an unfortunate circle, which we think must be broken. Mr. Chairman, I want to reiterate that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is committed to move forward to develop the details of a regional cap and trade system in the Midwest. Our constant caution, as you might expect, is that we must always take into account the impact on consumers and the Minnesota economy. Our opposition to House File 3195 should in no way be viewed as an attempt to delay or block cap and trade. The process you set in motion last year in the Next Generation Energy Act is working. We learned in our MTAG work that the task is daunting. There is no magic wand of legislation that will make the 80% of our greenhouse gas emissions go away. To achieve the goal will require significant change in our economic and social behaviors, as well as major technological innovation. The Next Generation Energy Act and the MTAG process have put Minnesota on a climate change pathway. And we say, let's keep moving. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Any questions? Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Robertson, for this very thorough report from the Chamber. Helpful to us. Just a clarification then. My question previous was, how does this constrain our ability to actually negotiate a more regional agreement? I'm really not clear on how that would curtail our ability to do that. And so in the Chamber's view, how would that constrict our ability to actually have that agreement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, I think it would be very difficult for those involved in that process to take a position contrary to what has been adopted in legislation by the legislature. So within this bill, you would take specific positions on several major issues, including the major one of auctioning the allowances. And there would be folks within that process that would say, how could the negotiators step back from the legislative position that had been adopted? So I think the action is premature. I think that the legislature will take action on all of the major elements. This bill does not implement cap and trade. The process that's going on is going to continue to go on, and this doesn't get us one step closer to implementing a cap and trade system. That will only come when the details of a cap and trade system are brought before you to be encoded into law so that it can go out and be implemented. The difficulty is that we're saying now that it is advantageous for us to do this with other states, which involves them adopting laws and making sure that we have a system that can work even though there may be some local differences. Earlier it was mentioned, well, we could take a position on auctioning as Minnesota alone, and we could do it just on our own and let the other states make their own decisions. That would be a much worse situation. That would mean that the economic imbalance is even greater, because now you're requiring the Minnesota community of emitters and their consumers to pay a much higher cost for this than would be occurring in other states. So this is a debate with regard to the auctioning that is occurring now at the federal level. And there are ways to deal with it, as I mentioned, the five different options. And some variation of that will be the final solution at the federal level or at a regional level. But it's premature to make that decision today.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Robertson, I know how hard you work on this, so I'm a little wary of getting into a tit for tat with you. And respectfully so. I'd like to refer back to the point that Representative Reinert made, in that the Minnesota Legislature, we obviously have a great concern about this issue and want to inject ourselves into this discussion, as opposed to receiving a an agreement back and either giving a thumbs up or thumbs down. So regardless of where this bill goes, which I support some form of, I would like to, I mean, I think there are many of us who want to be more intimately involved in that process, and in absence of any other strategy for us and the legislature to do that, I mean, this is our means to do so. I don't know if you want to comment on that, or it's more just...
Mr. Chairman, I totally understand that concern and that frustration, and there should be mechanisms for legislators to have input. And, you know, the report that is in the bill and that Mr. Garvey said he would support ensures that, and there, you know, certainly could be other periods along the way when gatherings and opportunities for legislative discussion of where the negotiations are would be very appropriate.
And Representative Gardner has a question as well.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass. I think I've got it in here somewhere.
Okay. Are there any further questions for Mr. Robertson? Okay, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next on the list, we have John Rolfe from Medtronic. Welcome, Mr. Rolfe.
Thank you.
State your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Rolfe. I'm here representing Medtronic. I'm, I guess, uniquely positioned here as one of the few people in the room that actually uses energy. Most people here are in the policy side, they're in the production side, the distribution side, and I'm kind of here to represent the people that actually have to make the reductions happen, because that's what it all comes down to. A little background, I've been in Medtronic now a little over a year, came from Ford Motor Company. I was in their global engineering office for 20 years. I've been doing energy efficiency projects for the last 15 years or more. I tried to count and I lost track. I'm probably up to about $30 million worth of projects that I have personally put in and got running. Lighting projects, HVAC projects. I've even done some hydropower here in St. Paul. Temperature control, you name it, I've been involved. And I want to tell you, these are really lofty goals, but this stuff is not easy. This is hard to do. It's everybody doing a little bit. It's a death by a thousand cuts. Okay? I mean, imagine your own home and reduce 30-40% of your energy. I dare you to try to do that. Economically feasible. You're not going to go buy a $2,500 refrigerator, even though the old one is working, to save $100 a month. If you did, that would be irresponsible. So that's the kind of scale that makes this stuff really hard to do. So I just want to make sure you understand that when we put these goals out there, and I believe me, I'm in favor of these goals. I just want to let you know how difficult it is. Another main point I want to make is, what is the whole purpose of this? What is the goal? Don't take your eye off the ball. The goal is reduce greenhouse gases. That's it. And there's only two ways to do that. Use less or get alternate supply. That's it. It's not rocket science. So you got to, it's a two-legged thing there. You got to make sure you have both. Alternate supply, I think, was covered very well in the last year's legislation. Minnesota's made great strides on the renewable standards. On the consumption side, it was addressed with some increase in the SIP program. So that's how you do it. I think you're on the right step. I think the bill's got many good ideas. There's many good concepts. The MTAG report is an outstanding piece of work from a whole bunch of people. So I think that's a model for many other things, not just energy. But I do have an area of concern on the cap and trade. I was involved as Ford Motors rep on the Chicago Climate Exchange initial startup in 1999, and we had many heated discussions on direct and indirect emissions and who counts what and who gets credit for what, and if I do this, it's my credit, no, it's your credit, and it gets pretty complicated pretty quick. It's also greenhouse gas tracking, again, is really hard to do.
Well, I did a building addition. No, but we just bought a company. Now, do I have to count them? No, we sold the company. So do I get credit for selling them? Well, we just outsourced a bunch of stuff to China. So do I get credit for that? But actually, it's dirtier because now it's got to go back and forth a few times across the ocean. So it suddenly spirals into a very complicated tracking system. And what it really shows is that carbon is a global issue. It's not about us making very strict clean water laws for our own lakes and rivers. This is about a global issue that has to be addressed globally, not isolated in a little pocket up in the Midwest here. So the federal system is the only logical approach to do it. It makes a level playing field across the country. Are they going to act quick enough for us? Probably not. Do we want them to go quicker? Yes. Do we do something that is going to then be temporary and we spend all the time and effort for a 1.5-year program that then the feds come in and trumpet? Or do we want to create a system that's the model for the feds? I'm not offering the answer. I'm just saying it's something to consider. I do believe, though, that no auction should be included. All the other parts of the bill, I think, are pretty good, but I don't believe the auction is the way to go, whether it's the state, regional, or federal. I believe there should be some sort of penalty for not meeting your efficiency targets. That's a different issue. So to have to pay that money up front to even start to operate is a pretty difficult pill to swallow. And the big reason is, I mean, let's not kid ourselves, this is a carbon tax. I know that's a bad word, but it is a carbon tax. And the biggest problem I have is it's going to tie up a lot of capital that would otherwise be used to implement the efficiency project. Now, it's going to come down to cost, right? We're in business. Another question is, this is kind of like a huge SIP program. You collect all this money, and then it gets redistributed back out to help the issue you're trying to solve. My question is, and I've never had an answer because nobody knows, how efficient is the existing SIP process? Nobody knows. How much of the money actually goes back to the end users that had the money taken from them to get back to them again? So if I'm paying, make up a number, $100,000 a year into the SIP program at Medtronic, how much of that actually comes back to me? There's overhead, there's operating, there's all sorts of studies, there's all this other stuff. And how much of that actually went into changing out lights and putting in boilers? I don't know. Well, if we're going to take that and multiply it into the billions of dollars, we better have an analysis on how efficient the existing process is, because I don't think it's going to work very well. It's not going to be as efficient as if I just did it myself. On the cost side, the raw energy costs are going to continue to go up. I think most people agree with that. Well, there's lots of other costs that are adding to this. The renewable energy standard, that ain't free. It costs more. So my costs there are going to go up. But my question then is, who owns that credit? If I'm going to have to go out and auction, well, by the new RES standards, we're now 25% renewable. So that means my rates went up. Does that mean I own that credit? So that means I don't have to buy those credits? Or does utility own the credit because they're the ones that put up the windmill? I don't know. And until those kinds of questions get answered, people like me that have to tell my boss, hey boss, I got to go out and buy $1 million for the credits, I got to give him a number. And I don't know what that number is today because there's a lot of other decisions that haven't been made. It's all about tracking, and the tracking is expensive. Greenhouse gas tracking reporting will increase my cost. I don't disagree. It has to be done. But it's yet another little death of 1,000 cuts today. Now increases my cost. So I don't think we need to have this form of a carbon tax. I think we need to have some sort of penalty for not complying with efficiency standards. I do think we need to start tracking now. We have to get this ball rolling. So I would like to have it changed a little bit to say, at least at the start, we have to start tracking, we have to start reporting, we have to start setting targets. Then we can get, based on that knowledge, you know, what's the emission factor of all these sectors? I don't know. Does anybody know? So until we know, we don't know what the real economic impact is. I don't even know if I'm included in this sector. It says large industrials. I don't know what that means. What does that mean, and does that change? And do we allow new industrials that want to move in, the new windmill manufacturers, all these green jobs we're going to create? Are we going to invite them into the state and then make them buy the credits? Or are we going to give them a freebie for a while, some incentive package? I don't know. But it gets very difficult when you get into the details. So I guess my purpose, when I'm done, is just to let you know efficiency is difficult. It is hard. It takes a lot of attention, just like weight loss. It's very easy. You think you do all the right things, and then one day, boom, you just blow it. It's gone. And that's how hard it is. It's very, you can change a building, you do the lights, you do the temperatures, you do all this, and 2 years later you go back and you find out it crept right back up to where it used to be. Just like my waistline. So it's just, it's hard to do. So my comments are done. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Rolfe. Any questions for Mr. Rolfe? Okay, seeing none. Thanks. We have next Mr. Bob Schulte, the Central Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Schulte. I'm Chief Executive Officer of Central Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, CMMPA, or CMPA. Not to be confused with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency called CMPA, our larger cousins in Rochester. CMPA is a nonprofit wholesale electric power supplier and services agency serving 12 municipal utility members in Central and Southern Minnesota. Our members are the consumers they serve. In discussions like this, sometimes people draw a line between utility interests and consumer interests. For our members, for public power entities like our members, they are one and the same. CMPA and its members favor a federal approach to carbon regulation to establish a large market for diverse options and pricing to lower costs and ensure a level playing field among states. But failing a federal approach, and a number of us are impatient with the federal government, a regional approach with which the MCAG and the governor has proposed is far better than a state-only cap-and-trade for reasons people have talked about earlier. I won't repeat those. In our view, this bill, while its preamble states that it supports a regional cap-and-trade program, it seems to default to a state-only program. This bill needs to decide what it wants, in our minds. We are concerned that the bill essentially ties the shoelaces together of the regional effort. Some examples, what we believe to be an unrealistic deadline, December 2008, for the regional program to be developed and put in place. We read with some concern that if it doesn't have it all the way to the end by December 1, the report should also include what we're going to do next, join another regional group or have a state cap-and-trade program. We're concerned that it's jumping the gun. Also, requirements that only Minnesota can define allowances and that all allowances must be auctioned, ignoring the fact that other states may have their own opinions, as been talked about earlier. We think that's inhibiting the regional effort. We think there needs to be a more flexible approach to that rather than a state things set in law. We are concerned that this is setting the regional effort up for failure using the definitions of this bill, a bill that at its base purports to support such a regional effort. Regarding costs, and some other folks have talked about this, there's been no testimony or evaluation regarding the provisions of the bill that would allocate carbon allowances or auction them off, or even if they should be auctioned off. And these are big dollar items for Minnesota consumers. Mr. Robinson from the Chamber of Commerce talked about a number of $5 billion. That was all industries, so we are electric-focused in our agency. Electric emissions are about a third in round numbers of the total all emissions. So that number for just electric customers, five billion divided by three, is still a very large number, and that because that's based on tons per year, that could be an every year type of number for electric consumers. And this is only their electric bills. Additional effects on their natural gas bills, which are very likely to go up under carbon regulation, cost of goods and services they buy, and transportation methods would be additive to this. With regard to the bill's provisions to auction off all carbon allowances, we have heard proponents call this a cap-and-trade and auction bill, but we also, like earlier folks, see this as what it is. We think the legislature should pierce through the fancy language and call this what it is. This is a cap-and-tax bill. And it doesn't matter if the auction is variable rather than a fixed amount of tax. It's a carbon tax, one and the same. At the federal level, such auctions are called stealth taxes. in this context. Stealth, because the tax appears on your utility bill, not on a bill directly from the government. The effect on CMMPA members, whose owners are the consumers themselves, see the term auction as the tax it really is. Finally, the bill specifies that all allowances be auctioned off, and some of the folks before me had talked about this. In contrast, leading federal bills initially allocate a portion of the allowances at no cost and then phase them out over time. Now, this isn't, in our mind, encouraging polluters to pollute. It isn't reducing the value of the program, as an earlier person talked about. But it's done for a very simple purpose. In the utility business, we have a term we call rate shock. And rate shock is when you see a very large investment or cost coming toward your consumers, you try not to hit them all at once with it. Okay? And you try to phase it in. You have it go in steps over time. And so that is a large reason why at the federal level you see some of the allowances are provided at no cost early. Why? To avoid, in this case, tax shock, so consumers can take on these impacts to their budgets gradually. You don't want to hit the brakes on the car to stop carbon emissions and send the consumer's budgets right through the windshield. That could undo all the things you're trying to do with the carbon regulation. If you're going to have an impact, you should ease it in over time so consumers, taxpayers, voters can then absorb that into their budgets in a more regular. We think that's in the interest of carbon regulation to phase things in rather than hit them all at once. And as I mentioned earlier, those are very large numbers. We strongly encourage the legislature to consider these effects, and as outlined in the Economics and Emissions Study in Section 5 of the bill, we think that's a very good idea. In fact, this single section alone in this study is probably as important at this point as all the other provisions of the bill. In summary, if you want a regional approach, we suggest that the bill should facilitate such an approach rather to basically be looking like a state approach. And the potential cost of the bill to Minnesota consumers are very high. This should be considered in the study in Section 6 that's in the bill. And in fact, we would respectfully suggest the study should be done before proceeding with other portions of the bill, because those are just as important to our consumers and our customers as other portions. So thank you for the opportunity to talk today and answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Schulte. Representative Wagenia.
Thank you. I hear you arguing on your consumer's behalf. I mean, that's the argument you're trying to make here. So let me just pose a question to you. Are you doing everything you can to help consumers reduce their electric use? And I'm going to give you an example of why I think we haven't gone down that path very far. I'm using my brother as an example. He is a CPA, so when he tells me numbers, I know they're right. He had an ordinary three-bedroom home built in 1932, and he sold it and bought one of these big new houses, which is 2.5 times bigger. And because it was a new house and it was well insulated, his electric cost dropped, or his heating cost, all his energy costs dropped like a rock. And for a house that's that much bigger, in central Minnesota, just like in the cities, there are a lot of old houses that are just leaking all over the place. Are you helping those homeowners?
Mr. Schulte.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a great question. No, we're not. And I'll tell you why. Last year, this legislature passed a very big renewable energy standard, a very aggressive conservation standard. I know how impressive those numbers are, because I'm the original author of the conservation program utilities offered 20-some years ago. It started the CIP program, and I ran NSP's conservation program years later. Those bills you did last year are going to move us along to doing a much better job, us, CMMPA, all the other utilities, all of us, to move along to a very much more positive and energy-efficient approach, just as your question suggests, Representative Wagenius. Those bills, in our view, are doing the lion's share of the carbon impacts, energy efficiency impacts, the energy independence things, and jobs for renewables in Minnesota and conservation jobs in Minnesota are doing a much bigger job than this bill would do. In fact, without this bill, those things will happen. So do we need to do a better job in conservation to answer your question? Absolutely. And we're heading that direction thanks to the legislation and our efforts. So I think the legislature should take great credit for that.
Representative Ogenius.
There's a great difference between heading in the right direction and getting the job done. And so my very specific question is, are you helping your homeowners in older homes insulate, retrofit, caulk, do all those kinds of things where they could reduce their energy bill probably by about half?
We will be, and we'll be filing our plan to do that this summer with Commerce per the legislation last year. So, right on, that needs to be done, Representative. I agree with you.
Okay, and if I could finally, what portion of your consumers will see a benefit from that?
Mr. Schulte.
Will it be 100%?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we believe they'll all benefit whether they each of them participate or not.
That's not my question. The question was, will each individual homeowner, I mean, are we really targeting so that each homeowner gets a reduced electric bill because they're well insulated and well caulked now?
Mr. Schulte.
The initial impacts, the most cost-effective impacts for conservation is probably on the commercial and industrial side. That's where we'll save more carbon. After that, whether each individual homeowner reduces their electric bill depends on their response to the program, something that we, even as aggressive as we plan to be, cannot prescribe. So is our aim to reduce the bills of our consumers in their homes? Yes. We have no profit motive to not have them do that.
Well, I guess what I hear is when you argue for your consumers, I hear more of an argument for your commercial consumers rather than your individual homeowner consumers.
Chairman, Representative Venus, I respectfully disagree with that. Okay. That's not what I said. I said that if you want carbon reductions, and that's the discussion we're having here, if you want carbon reductions, in my experience from running conservation programs and operating conservation programs, you're going to save more energy per dollar, more carbon per dollar, if you go toward at the commercial operators where you can have a bigger impact for lower dollars. It doesn't mean you cut the residentials out. I'm just telling you, if you're looking for carbon impact, more of it is going to come at lower dollar impact with the commercial industrial sector, and that's something that's pretty generally known within the industry. Does that mean we're not going to do residential? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And we'll go house to house as needs be because it's in our consumers' interest, whether they participate in the program or a commercial customer participates in the program and reduces costs for everybody. That's a benefit. We need to do a lot more conservation, and the legislation was right on in that. We aim to comply.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Schulte. Next we have Ms. Deb Bergen, Missouri River Energy. Welcome, Ms. Bergen. If you could state your name, please.
Good evening. Thank you, Chairman Eakin and committee members. My name is Deb Bergen. I'm the Manager of State Legislative Affairs for Western Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, which is actually the financing affiliate for Missouri River Energy Services. And thank you tonight. And in regards to Chairman Eakin's comments earlier, I will try to edit my comments as I go so I'm not repetitive and do the best I can on that. Missouri River Energy Services has 60 member communities in Minnesota, Iowa, North and South Dakota. 24 of these 60 communities are right here in Minnesota. We understand the desire in Minnesota to take action on climate control. In the past, we have given testimony opposing a state-specific piecemeal cap-and-trade type program. So we are pleased that the authors of House File 3195 also believe that a cap-and-trade program is best achieved at a regional, if not national, level. As many people have already testified today, a cap-and-trade is, at its essence, a market. And markets work best when you have multiple participants and multiple sectors involved. and that's what makes a market run the best. But we do have some concerns with House File 3195. First of all, it's important to note that all of our member communities are municipal electric communities. Each is fully owned by the customers they serve. Therefore, each of these communities and MRAS itself are not-for-profit and use cost-based rates. Any increase in cost to the utility is an increased cost to the consumer, and therefore we are concerned about consumer impact and protection. And I'm reiterating a primary concern that you've already heard today, that with the implementation of a 100% auction approach to cap and trade. As you heard earlier, currently the federal legislation under consideration, most importantly the Lieberman-Warner bill, allocates 73.5% of its allowances in 2012 while submitting the rest to an auction program. And then it breaks down those no-cost allowances to several sectors. Electric power generation, to the states themselves to do with as they please, to low-serving entities, as well as to rewards for early action. And we think that is a good report, good style to do a cap and trade in. For example, in the electric generation industry, we rely heavily on fossil fuels, primarily coal and natural gas. But demand for generation won't significantly diminish. In fact, MAP studies, the NERC studies, and even the MCCAG pointed to the fact that there will still be some increase in electric demand. So requiring an industry with basically an inelastic demand, like the electric generation industry, to bid on allowances will set the market price and will set it high as you bid for those allowances. By allowing the majority of the allowances to be distributed at no cost, however, will help alleviate the cost to customers. Now, as I say this, we do not advocate a 100% allocation of all allowances at no cost. As we have seen in Europe, free allocation of allowances without a proper system of checks and balances has allowed abuses of the system, and this cannot be tolerated. In addition, the European model has demonstrated that any legislation must also include provisions to minimize the potential for market manipulation. And that's true whether we look at a hybrid system or a total free allocation system. That's something we need to address going forward. But with a hybrid approach where we have some allocations auctioned and some given freely to industries, we, for covered sources with growing demand, we allow for the customer to benefit by lessening price impact, particularly in the early stages of moving to a carbon-reduced economic system. At the same time, a hybrid approach would limit the amount of free allowances distributed, thwarting those who would use the allowance system to gain the market. Therefore, we request that the legislature undertake the study recommended in, I believe it was Section 4, and use it to carefully examine the costs, administrative pitfalls, and the market impacts of various allowance allocation methods before committing to one particular mode or fashion. As many people noted here earlier today, I was also a member of the MK Cap and Trade Technical Work Group, and we spent many months studying the modeling on basic costs and looking at various systems. And what we came to a group opinion on was that a state-only cap and trade was not preferable, rather a regional or national approach was. And while members on the work group had their opinions about an allowance allocation or allowance auction, and recommended that a hybrid of auction and free allocations be looked at, we did not undertake an extensive analysis, and that should be done when we look at the NTA process or going forward, because that was not done by the cap and trade quig or by the MK, looking at what a hybrid program would do to the consumer. Another major concern with any cap and trade legislation is consumer costs, of course. The Lieberman-Warner bill not only contains allowance allocations at no cost to protect consumers, but the legislation also allows for banking, trading, and offsetting of allowances. These cap and trade parameters make the market flexible and less price volatile. However, the concern of cost, particularly on the middle and lower income households, is paramount. These price increases oftentimes are regressive in nature, in that poorer households would bear a larger burden relative to their income rather than wealthier households. Therefore, again, MRAS asks this legislature to consider examining a safeguard approach or other cost relief measures in a cap and trade system, in the cap and trade recommendations in this bill. Lastly, in order to reach our goals while still maintaining our standard of living, the development of new technology is paramount. In the bill before you today, in the fund set aside with the proceeds from the auction allowances, we see a lot of the spending directed towards directly alleviating costs and investing in energy efficiency programs. While using the proceeds from allowance auction to aid lower-income residential customers is admirable, it is only one small band-aid. The lower-income customer will not only be subject to higher electric prices, but higher costs for gasoline, home heating, manufactured goods, retail services, and food. The advantage of new technological advances, whether they come in the electric sector, agricultural sector, food processing sector, or any other sector, will in turn reduce costs for consumers. It will lower emissions directly and permanently. With this investment, all sectors will experience long-term cost benefits, will have allowances to trade, and these benefits will be passed on to consumers. Costs will be stabilized and there will be less need for cost relief measures. Therefore, we urge this committee and the legislature to consider allocating at least part of the proceeds from an auction to research and development in new technology, again, regardless of what sector that new technology may come in. So I urge this committee and the legislature as a whole to consider the balance needed in any greenhouse gas policy. While getting to the emission goal, consumer impact should be the ultimate concern, and it can be best addressed by allowing for both auction and free allocation of emission allowances, by employing cost relief measures or safeguards, and by investing in far-sighted cost-saving technology. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bergen. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Bergen. Thanks for coming to my office earlier. And I read your material or thirding the material, and it's been helpful. Just a quick question for you, a comment and then a question. You made the statement earlier today and then here also that there's kind of an inelastic level of which, especially industrial producers, can't go below effectively. And so you would recommend that we give a free allocation to a certain percentage of that. I guess I'd like a little more explanation of that. I mean, as I understand it, kind of on a cursory level, there are large, say, forest products businesses up north who have actually done some considerable conservation measures. There's a cogeneration facility at our unit at Potlatch Mill up north, and I think they've done some work on their own, I think as a cost-reducing measure to reduce their energy consumption. I would argue that, you know, that there should be some means to continue to entice them or encourage them to continue to do so. Maybe you can explain that a little bit more. I mean, how do you encourage that, given if we're just giving the free allocation to a certain percentage of businesses?
Okay, I see a couple questions, actually. Sorry. Mr. Chairman, you can represent Mo. I see actually a couple questions in there. One issue I see, for example, is our peaking station in Exira, Iowa. We have a 140-megawatt natural gas peaking facility. Regardless of what we do with energy efficiency measures or SIP, at the end of the day, we will still have the 100-degree day in August, in which we will need to run a facility like that. What concerns me about a 100% auction measure, say the entire MGA adopted that measure, we would be competing for our 140-megawatt peaking plant that we don't run all the time, but we need to have it available for those peak days. We'd be competing for those allowances at auction against, say, a Google, which is looking at coming into Iowa, or against a large taconite manufacturer, which may be better at passing on the cost to the consumers, or may be able to bid up the price higher and get those allowances where we do not. In that situation, if we don't give enough allowances to run our peaking on the days we need it, then we would be looking at perhaps buying on the market, the open generation market, which would usually be a higher cost than running our own peaking facility. Or we would have to forego the allowances because they've reached that threshold beyond what we would have to purchase on the market on our peak day.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So you're not saying that we wouldn't, be encouraging some efficiency there. You're essentially arguing that the price would be so exorbitant in doing so that it probably wouldn't be worth it. Is that?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I guess there's a couple concerns there. We would still be encouraging efficiency, but what I'm saying is when you look at something like electricity, there's always a certain amount of electric need that will always be there with consumers. And a lot of that need is currently provided by existing resources that are working well. For example, we have a lot of natural gas peaking, but with the MRF project, Xcel Energy converted a lot from large scale generation to natural gas, which also emits CO2. So what I'm saying is those entities would best be covered by some free allowances because they would have to run to meet that electric demand that's always there. We always have a threshold to run our lights, our computers, that part of the electric demand that is not a luxury, it's a necessity.
Thank you, Ms. Bergen. Any other questions? Okay, thanks again. And we have next Mr. Doug Peterson, CenterPoint Energy. Again, if you could state your name and position for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Doug Peterson. I'm the Director of Marketing and Sales at CenterPoint Energy. Similar to many others that have been here before, I'm also a member of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, and I was also on the MCAG Technical Work Group on Cap and Trade. I'm here today on behalf of CenterPoint Energy's 800,000 customers, of which 95% are either residential or small commercial customers that primarily use natural gas to heat their homes and businesses. I have really three points I'd like to make tonight. The first is that the proposed principles in the bill on cap and trade result in the most costly approach to achieving greenhouse gas emissions. As I learned in the cap and trade work group, the primary purpose of the cap and trade program is to reduce the cost of compliance through a trading mechanism with other parties. This bill, however, requires all of the most costly approaches. As others have mentioned, it requires a 100% auction allowances on day one of the program. It allows no offsets from other areas, and it provides for no safety valve if allowance prices go too high. It appears that the primary purpose of this bill is not to reduce the cost of compliance, but instead is to raise revenue. For CenterPoint Energy, we've done some cost analysis. We estimate that this bill will cost our customers between $70 and $140 million per year in 2015, rising to $150 to over $300 million per year in 2025. These costs will be passed on to our customers just like a tax. The average residential customer would pay $50 to $100 per year in 2015, and that amount would double to $100 to $200 per year in 2025. For the state as a whole, the MCAG independent consultant projected, and Mr. Robertson already spoke to this number, he projected that the auction approach would cost Minnesota $5 billion per year in 2025. This is an amount that we believe that could seriously harm the Minnesota economy. The second point I'd like to make is that the proposed principles in the bill are unfair to companies trying to comply with the 2007 greenhouse gas reduction requirements. Last year, and this has been mentioned previously as well, the legislature passed Chapter 216H, requiring greenhouse gas emission reduction of 15% in 2015, 30% in 2025, and 80% in 2050. This was a very aggressive, yet phased-in approach to addressing the climate change issue. The legislature knew it would not be possible to go from no regulation of carbon to 100% regulation of carbon all at once. The auction requirement in this bill is inconsistent with this approach. Even if a company spends millions of dollars to achieve compliance with the greenhouse gas reduction target, the auction requirement would still force them to buy additional allowances at a potential cost of millions of dollars more. It is simply unfair, we believe, to require companies that are in compliance with the greenhouse gas reduction target to have to pay for additional allowances. The third point I'd like to make is one that's been touched on a little bit already, but that is that we believe that this cap and trade bill is premature at this time. The bill acknowledges that there are many important questions to be answered and requires a study on these questions in Section 6, Subdivision 4. We agree that more work is needed on several of these important questions, such as, what will the allowance prices actually be? What will the increases in energy prices be? What is the impact of various greenhouse gas reduction actions? And what industries will be put at a competitive disadvantage? Quite frankly, these are questions that need to be answered before passing a law on cap and trade principles. In fact, the last question on competitive disadvantage for industries is especially important, we believe. If Minnesota mandates 100% auction as proposed in this bill before the regional process is even started, other states, such as Wisconsin or Iowa, could use that to their advantage. For example, they could say, if Minnesota is 100% auction, let's adopt a 20% auction approach and encourage businesses to move to our state with lower compliance costs. The NCAG, Cap and Trade Work Group, worked on these issues for several months and finally recommended that more study was needed, especially on several hybrid options that contain a combination of allocation and auction approaches. Mr. Robertson mentioned this, but I think it's worth mentioning just three of these examples, these hybrid examples. First, a partial auction, partial allocation. Secondly, a shift from allocation to auction over time, which is similar to some of the principles in the federal bill. And third, an auction for unregulated companies, an allocation for regulated companies, such as regulated utilities, which will not be able to take advantage of any type of windfall recovery through an auction. We agree with the NCAG that more study is needed on these complex issues. So, briefly, in conclusion, we believe the proposed principles in the bill are excessively costly and could damage the Minnesota economy. There's also no pressing need to decide these program design issues now before several important questions can be answered. We urge you to follow the NCAG cap and trade recommendation to continue to study all the various cap and trade approaches and to not mandate the most costly approach at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, I just have, you know, if we want to reach the greenhouse gas reduction targets in 2058, and you say this bill is bad, and we want to find out the economic effects, and that could take some time, and people say they want to have a federal bill, but we know that that doesn't work. We've seen that in health care. What then would be your alternative approach to reach those targets?
Mr. Peters.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that we are well on our way to meeting those targets. The law that was passed last year to require the renewables for electric utilities, to require all the utilities to increase their energy efficiency, is putting us, those existing actions is going to put us well on our way. The NCAG looked at this. I think you've heard from Director Garvey respond to the slope of the line. It's not business as usual. If the NCAG actions are adopted, we will be meeting our 2015 targets and we'll be well on our way. I think we may even be meeting our 2025 targets. So I think those things can be accomplished. I'm not suggesting that the state should not support a cap and trade program. I'm just suggesting that we should not support principles in that program that will produce a very costly program and will put us outside the mainstream in terms of what other states in our area will be doing.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none. Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you.
And next on the agenda we have Mr. Lauren Logtug from the Otter Tail Power Company.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Warren Lotzak from Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. And I'll be very brief. I think most of what I intended to say has already been said by other testifiers. Let me just start by suggesting that our concern is that the bill is quite restrictive. And I would like to agree with Mr. Garvey's interpretation that the bill is restrictive in the sense that it says that Minnesota's cap and trade needs to look like this box. And I'll refer to lines like 2.21 that says the cap and trade program must be in accord with these principles. That in 3.10, it must prohibit the issuance of additional allowances, for example. In line 3.19, the legislature must approve in all particulars whatever is brought back from the Midwest Greenhouse Gas Accord. And if it does not match up, then it's given to the commissioners of the Department of Commerce and the MPCA to identify what the options are for developing a greenhouse gas program that does look like this. So my interpretation is that it is very restrictive and it does require that it looks like this. I thought that in keeping with this, I found something. I went looking on the federal website. I follow federal affairs for my company, too. And last December 5th, the Senate Environment Public Works Committee marked up the federal bill. The only bill that's been passed in committee at the federal level is the S-2191, the Lieberman-Warner Climate Security Act, which has been referenced a number of times today. And I brought to the committee's attention and use just a copy from Senator Klobuchar's website. Senator Klobuchar serves on Senate EPW, and I highlighted the paragraph in this document, or in her newsletter on her website, that says that the EPW committee also passed Klobuchar's amendment that would require the National Academy of Sciences to study the feasibility of distributing bonus allowances to producers of clean, renewable electricity. The only reason I bring this to the committee's attention is I think it shows a level of creativity at the federal level with respect to allowances that's not mentioned in the bill that we have before us. It's not in what we have today. So I would just suggest that if there's some other creative approaches to doing this sort of thing, that that's something that the author might consider. And the only other thing I'll say is the study that's in Subdivision 4 looks very useful because the state needs to know what are the economic impacts and it needs to think about what the job impacts are. I have also asked to have handed out to you a one page from the American Council for Capital Formation that deals with the Lieberman-Warner Act. And what everyone needs to understand is that to achieve the goals that are in anything like even the Lieberman-Warner Act, there will be an economic cost attached to that in terms of jobs and in terms of energy prices and in terms of economic growth. And so I just offer this to you. My question is, my company supports a national program. What's the value in doing a Minnesota-only program? Now, in SO2 reductions, we have reductions. SO2 has some local effects. Carbon dioxide does not. And on the other side of that, there are significant potential economic downsides to doing a Minnesota-only, or even the states that are in the MGGA, there are only six states, including Minnesota. Even a regional program has its challenges in terms of competitive advantages and disadvantages. If we do something on our own, we run the risk of driving capital and jobs to other states, at the very least, or to other countries, which is the more likely scenario, in my opinion. Mr. Chair, this concludes my comments, and I'll stand for questions.
Mr. Lartag, any questions? Seeing none. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And next on our list, we have Mr. Bob Ambrose, Great River Energy. Mr. Ambrose, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You can state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Bob Ambrose. I'm Director of Governmental Affairs for Great River Energy. I, too, was a member of an MTAG working group, the Cap and Trade Working Group and the Energy Supply Working Group. So for many of us, this is deja vu all over again. Great River Energy is an electric generation and transmission cooperative. We're providing energy to 28 local electric distribution co-ops who own us. Our members, in turn, provide power to their 600,000-plus members across two-thirds of Minnesota's landmass. Great River Energy is here today to support a comprehensive national approach to addressing the global problem of climate change. We believe that Minnesota's governmental, business, and environmental groups should focus their efforts on seeking passage of a national cap-and-trade system that could make a real difference in global efforts to solve the climate change problem. Concentrated attention on this national goal could result in the enactment of effective federal legislation within the next 1 to 2 years. The federal Lieberman-Warner cap-and-trade legislation that was just mentioned has already passed out of a committee in the U.S. Senate and may be debated on the Senate floor as early as this spring. Even if this federal legislation doesn't pass this year, it now appears that the likely presidential nominees of both major parties will be proposing a national cap-and-trade plan soon after taking office, probably based on the Lieberman-Warner bill with their own tweaks added. Great River Energy believes that any cap-and-trade plan should have the following key elements. It should have the broadest possible coverage of the sectors of our economy. There should be an allocation of emission allowances to current sources at the outset of the program. There should be a gradual reduction of the cap over time to meet the goal. There should be a gradual phase-in of auctioning of allowances to pay for the necessary research, development, and commercialization of technological solutions. There should be incentives for early action to reduce emissions, and there should be a monetary safety valve on the price of the auctioned allowances. We believe that a national plan structured in this way could achieve the desired reductions in greenhouse gas emissions while avoiding an immediate rate shock, as mentioned by some other testifiers, that could have the unfortunate effect, in our view, of making solution of this global problem politically unsustainable. The Green Solutions Act of 2008 presents substantial problems. Among them are, if a regional plan rather than a national plan, it would auction 100% of the emission allowances, thereby driving up the cost of energy before feasible technological mechanisms for reducing carbon from existing sources are researched, developed, and demonstrated at commercial scale. For Great River Energy, the cost of a 100% auction of allowances at a relatively modest $20 per ton cost of CO2 would be $260 million per year. $20 is at the low end, but we are a cooperative. All of that $260 million would be passed on to the rural and suburban member owners of our co-ops across the state. At a more likely level, in fact, let's pick $46 as was modeled by the MCAG group per ton. I have no real knowledge whether it's going to be 10, 20, 40, 60. There are various studies out there that have all those numbers in the range. But at $46 a ton, as modeled by MCAG, it comes to a nice round $698 million per year. That's almost identical to our total revenue requirements per year at the current time. By driving up the cost of energy and imposing the cap on major industrial facilities in Minnesota. It would put our major industries at a competitive disadvantage with those in competing states and nations. Under this bill, greenhouse gas reductions must be made in sectors covered by the cap and trade program, thus precluding offsets of emissions from agricultural and the forestry sectors through terrestrial sequestration, for example. Part of the benefit of a market system is that you can find offsets for your emissions. That is precluded in the principles that are in this bill. There also are no incentives in this bill for early action to reduce emissions, and there's no safety valve on the price of emission allowances that would be auctioned. In conclusion, yesterday, the U.S. House Energy and Commerce Committee issued a climate change white paper, and this is what they said about state or regional cap and trade plans. Quote, once a national economy-wide cap and trade program is adopted, and that's exactly what we're advocating, state or regional cap and trade programs may interfere with the efficient functioning of the federal cap and trade program and increase demand on both governmental and non-governmental resources. If there are multiple programs, multiple government agencies will be expending resources on those cap and trade programs without necessarily achieving more greenhouse gas reductions than a single national program. With a national economy-wide cap on emissions, a more stringent state or regional cap might shift emissions from the more stringent state to other states without reducing national greenhouse gas emissions. In this scenario, requiring regulated entities to comply with multiple cap-and-trade programs, which would likely require different compliance strategies, would likely increase the expenditure of non-governmental resources as compared to having just one national program without reducing greenhouse gas emissions. For example, a regulated entity might have to buy both state and federal allowances to cover the same ton of greenhouse gas emissions. Different points of regulation or allocation methodologies between state and federal programs would also cause complications and increase resources necessary for compliance, end quote. Mr. Chairman and members, Minnesota passed, as has been noted earlier, some nation-leading legislation last year. That legislation is going to take us a long ways toward meeting the goals that have been discussed. Minnesota has helped shape the national agenda with that legislation and with other programs over the years where we've been leaders. In our view, now it is time for us to focus on getting the job done with a comprehensive national program that makes substantial progress towards solving this issue. Thank you very much, and I certainly welcome any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ambrose, let me just make a few comments and let you react to them.
Sure.
I do appreciate why you prefer the federal program, and I understand your challenge to us to do what we can to move that forward. But it's also the case that our state is engaging in an effort to move to a regional program.
Right.
First question to you, have you expressed concern to the governor about that involvement, and have you made the same case to the governor to act on behalf of the federal program?
Mr. Chair and Representative Reinhart, I have not made that case personally, but as any participant in the MCAG group will testify, I've made it on numerous occasions in the working group and to the full MCAG group. So our position is no surprise to the governor and his staff. I certainly recognize that. I mean, the reality is they're working on that. I just hope that there's a federal plan in place before we have to implement a regional one.
May I follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, and many of us have hoped for a very long time for federal action in this arena and haven't seen it. So I think we're looking for strategies at a variety of levels, and as state legislators at this point, I think our desire is to influence the regional discussion, because that's what seems most possible. So the question is, how can we best influence that regional discussion other than wait, as I said to Deputy Director Garvey, my dilemma is to think constructively about how we can create a model platform that challenges action at the regional and the national level. So I would ask everyone who's come up here and testified against this bill to come to the table and try to make it a better bill, because we want something. We want to do something that we think is a meaningful challenge to the discussion by way of principles, not by way of enacting an independent state system that will function, that will function on its own. We recognize the limits of that. But setting some parameters or principles so that we can engage that dialogue aggressively and constructively, because we think that's what the circumstances require.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Ambrose,
Representative Reiner, a couple things. First, I do believe that although the bill lists several items as principles, I do think that the effect of actually passing this bill with those principles in it will be to make the likelihood of agreement with other states less likely. I also certainly recognize the need that you and other members and each of us feel to do something. It's a strong imperative. And I can say that for myself personally as well. But our view is that spending thousands of hours and probably hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of dollars working on a regional plan is a distraction to what needs to be done at the national level.
Representative Kuhn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to refrain from making comments after every testifier because I think it'll slow us down quite a bit, although I'm going to try to wrap it up. I just want to clarify a couple facts. The $46 a ton that was modeled by the NTAG, I think it's important to note that that's the number for 2025 when we'll be trying to reach the goal of a 30% reduction. That is not a model for the cost of an allowance right when the program is implemented. And we've heard a lot about the Warner-Lieberman bill, and we've also now heard that all the major party presidential candidates support a cap and trade program. I do want to note that the two strongest candidates on the Democratic side have come out in support of 100% auction, and I think that's important to the discussion as well if we're going to be talking so extensively about the federal action.
Mr. Ambrose?
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would add, and I'm not firm on which number it is, I'm just pretty darn convinced it's not going to be $10 a ton, and I think 20 is probably the very low end. I've seen studies that range from 50 to 64. Whatever the number is, it's hundreds of millions of dollars just for our customers, much less other customers in the state. And I forgot my other point, so I'll be with it.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thanks. Mr. Ambrose. Next on the list is Mr. Huey Sundberg, Minnesota Rural Electric. Mr. Sundberg, state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Lee Sundberg. I'm with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Our association represents the 44 nonprofit member-owned distribution co-ops that serve in the state and the sixth generation and transmission co-ops that provide power to them. Our median size is about 6,400 customers in those 44 co-ops. And because of size and our locations where we are serving, the focus is on our member owners, the consumer. And in covering 85 to roughly 90% of the geographic area in the state, and other than the four metro area co-ops, our customers' average household income is about 73% of the state average. And in some areas, at 60%. A few, not many, a few are around 60%. So with our demographics, we have to be concerned about the size of the electric bill along with the environment and reliably keeping the furnace fan running and the dairy farms running. I think, too, I won't belabor the point about last year's action. Truly, indeed, it was two major steps. And based on our best estimates, the retail rate impact of those two programs, those two steps, the renewable energy mandate and the conservation spending program, will be relatively modest. It's, you know, 4.5 to 11, 12%, kind of depending on what input you put into those estimates. But bottom line seems to be modest. So indeed, you've already have confirming what's already been said, that you've passed and we are already planning major carbon dioxide reductions at an estimated modest price increase. But we are concerned now when you take this next step on the CO2 emissions reduction program. For example, not using the $46, but a more, what we think, realistic near-term amount of $35 a ton. We estimated the rate impact on our residential customers would be about $450 annually. And that's about a 40% increase. And there again, we're not, I don't think, stretching that into the far out years, but more, you know, near term. And so with that kind of impact, we want to help ensure a reasonable and workable CO2 emissions reduction program implemented at the right time. And we need the technology to develop that, and Representative Knuth's bill still has a number of good provisions from which we can work forward with, again, with the caveat, as my colleague Mr. Ambrose stated, with preference for a national program. But okay, with that being said, what can we do here? And we think there are a number of sections and provisions that we can work with and that offer a reasonable starting point. But there are also the restrictions and principles that we feel will lead to higher rate impacts on our members, and there too we have, has been expressed, I guess, quite a number of times already, some high impacts. So I'll just mention quickly four. Again, the 100% auctions of credit is indeed like a tax. I wasn't quite sure how to respond to the comments about assets. These are assets, and who gets them? And the assets should go to the government. And boy, that's a tax if I've ever heard of one. When you have assets that go to the government equals a tax, I guess. I heard it right from one of the proponents' testimony. Allowing credit allowances, I think, is a smart way. If we take the lessons learned from Europe, that we can have a successful CO2 reduction program, and I'm sure in Washington they also know the lessons from the mistakes made in Europe. And we can do this without a high cost. when setting allowances, we should, I want to emphasize that, as Mr. Ambrose did, we should recognize actions and reductions already made, and we should include a safety valve, and I know that can be risky. You have to be careful with safety valves, because they, like putting a maximum, can become the amount. So you gotta work with it. We recognize that, but we think we should give it some consideration. And finally, if a regional program should include an off-ramp, so that we don't have the inconsistencies or contradictions, if assuming that the federal program is enacted, when that is enacted in a year or two. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Sundberg. And next we have Mr. Doug Carnival, Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, and if you could state your name, please, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, representing the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, which are the 126 municipal utilities throughout the state of Minnesota. Greg Oxley, who was the Director of Government Affairs for MMUA, is in Washington today and asked me to stand in for him. Since I have a position statement on the thoughts of MMUA, I will simply limit my comments to 2 points. We do, in fact, as Mr. Ambrose has said, support a national solution to this problem, and secondly, think that any solution that proceeds forward on cap and trade needs to do an analysis of the effect on customers. With that, I'll give you our position statement so you can read it at your leisure as you consider this bill rather than take up any more of your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carnival. Any questions? Okay. Moving on, we have next Ms. Annette Henkel, Minnesota Utility Investors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Annette Henkel, and I'm with the Minnesota Utility Investors. We are a grassroots organization of about 27,000 members. And many of you know our members, been at some of our meetings, met our members at the day at the Capitol. You know our members are older, retired folks that have invested in Minnesota's investor-owned utilities. They've invested in these utilities because they consider them a safe, reliable investment. Truly, these utilities, most people consider them the widow and orphan stuff. But our members rely upon the dividends these companies provide for much of their for much of their livelihood in retirement. Our members have two hats. Real-life people, the customers who pay their electric and gas bills. And you've heard a lot about costs this evening. They give our members real pause. Many of our members are retirees on a fixed income that does not grow, and any additional costs are of great concern. But the other perspective that I would like to raise is from the investor perspective, the shareholders in these utility companies. In the last 2 years, you've heard a lot about, we've had a lot of mandates, programs imposed upon these companies. We've talked about them a lot today. The Mercury Reduction Program, the Renewable Energy Standards, which also requires significant investment in transmission, and the Conservation or Energy Savings Program that the legislature established last year. While all of these may be good programs, good initiatives, all of these cost money. And the utilities need to attract significant capital to get all these things done. And at this time, imposing the cost that could result from a cap and trade program without really knowing the ramifications of this program is of great concern. We're concerned that it could weaken the financial health of the companies that our members have invested in and rely upon. The legislature has taken great strides to address Minnesota's carbon footprint. I would just encourage the committee to be thoughtful and deliberative in our next step and not preclude any options or alternatives in the development of a cap and trade program as it moves forward, and it is moving forward. We know that the state is planning to move forward and working as a region to develop a program, and we would encourage the legislature to allow this to happen without any strings attached, but also work to determine what the cost ramifications of these programs would be and who would pay. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Henkel. Any questions? Okay, none. Thanks again. Ms. Greg Pagel. Mr. Pagel, please state your name, please.
My name is Greg Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association. Thank you for a chance to comment on the bill. The IMA is a trade association that makes made up of the six mines, iron mines up in northeastern Minnesota, and about 200 vendors. There are about 1,500 miners at this time, and approximately 10 to 12,000 employed through the vendors. We add approximately $1.2 billion to the state's economy every year. That is growing as more iron mines are being proposed and new plants are going to open. There's a projection that we'll need somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 construction workers within the next 3 to 7 years. Iron mining in Minnesota accounts for 80% of the iron ore, iron, and steel that's produced in the United States. It's this steel that's used in building bridges. It's used in reinforced concrete. That's what you reinforce it with, is iron. To the bill itself, the section I'm just going to talk about, no one's really touched on yet, is Section 3, Subdivision 2, where it talks about the sectors. Basically, what that does is require not only utilities, but large industrial customers to buy allowances and reduce their greenhouse gases. This has basically three effects on these large customers, not only the iron mines, but other large industries. One, we have to pay for the utility costs through our rates, the pass-throughs. Two, we're required to reduce the same energy that we're paying to help reduce the CO2 output. And three, we also pay for our own allowances and are required to reduce our own greenhouse gases. These pancaking effects is what basically a carbon tax will send a message to all industries, and specifically the iron ore industries, that Minnesota is not a place to do business. Industries will choose to invest somewhere else. They take these laws very seriously as they look at their 5, 10, and 15-year plans for capital investments. Investments they can make anywhere in the world. There was a comment earlier by Ms. Bergen that we can basically pass our costs on to someone else. And that really isn't true, because we're a global commodity, so the prices are set globally, in effect. Presently, China is the one that is setting those prices because of their demand. And I'll admit, they're high right now, which is good. So we're able to make some investments in Minnesota. The taconite pellet producers, though, since they cannot just pass those costs on in the market, must either absorb those costs, reduce those costs, or move to countries that don't have the constraints that they would meet by this bill. I guess kind of to wrap it up really quick for you, the largest producers of steel right now, and then the ones that are growing the most, is where the market is really expanding, and that's India and China. A recent article in the Wall Street Journal noted that while these two giants that are growing emerging countries still fire at each other over borders, they've made one agreement, and that agreement is that they should not be the ones working on global climate change. They want to leave that to the developed countries like the United States and Minnesota. The effect is, if this bill would move forward in the present state, you could actually increase greenhouse gases around the world. China right now, the steel production per ton emits 42% more carbon than what we do in the United States, because we are more efficient. You know, we've been leaders in this world in lots of ways, legislatively, but also in industry. We've been a leader in that by reducing our costs, by reducing our energy. And they're taking a lot of different steps, and I can give examples if you'd like, but at this point I conclude my testimony. If you have any questions. If there are any questions at all. Okay, seeing none, well, thank you, Mr. Hagel. Next we have Ms. Diane Schmidt. Welcome. You can state your name and position.
My name is Diane Schmidt, and I represent Flint Hills Resources. I do have my testimony, which I prepared, and rather than go through all of it, I thought it might be just helpful to just get in some of the issues that maybe are more unique to our testimony here today, and then answer any questions that you might have.
I think first and foremost, we're a little bit unique in this discussion this evening, and because we are not only a large consumer of electricity and energy, but we're also a large producer of energy. Flint Hills Resources is a refinery in Rosemont, and we make gasoline, diesel fuel, jet fuel, and many other products, which are distributed to customers all throughout the state. About half of the gasoline and diesel fuel that is used in Minnesota and powers cars, trucks, snowmobiles, boats, airplanes, is produced at the refinery. Actually, our refinery produces about 80 to 90% of the jet fuel for the airport. The company employs about 850 permanent workers and anywhere between 400 to 1,500 independent contractors, basically building trade workers. In addition to that, we're planning on adding 100 jobs. We've added 100 jobs and plan to add more. Since the year 2000, the company has invested over $1 billion in capital projects in the state, including a 50,000-barrel expansion at our refinery, because one of the things that we were hearing, both at the federal and state government, is that we did not have enough capacity, and therefore, the, you know, having to do with the pricing, supply-demand problem. According to the analysis at the Department of Employment and Economic Development, our facility impacts about 8,200 state jobs a year with a payroll of over $350 million per year. One of the things that I think is very important to just put on the record, and one of the things that I don't think anyone has stated yet, because I'm here principally representing transportation fuels and a large industrial site, is that it's important for this committee to know and to consider if you're going forward that this legislation will increase the price of gasoline. As we increase the cost that would be borne on us with our facility, those costs will be translated into higher costs to consumers. And I want to just state that, because whatever you do and however you analyze this as we go forward, I think it's extremely important that we know what we're doing. And as you go through your policy discussions, it's important for you to take that into consideration as you make important decisions about the future of our state. I'm going to skip down to my testimony and really get in large part as to why our facility and a large industrial site and the transportation fuels portion and sector of this pending legislation would have a significantly different effect on our facility. Technology does not exist that would help the refinery significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions as envisioned by the cap and trade system. As a result, refiners under this bill would have to immediately start buying credits. Under this bill, Flint Hills' cost of electricity would also be considerably higher, as in the fact that we are Xcel's largest customer. Another inherent problem with the current legislation is its conflict between both federal and state law. Currently, we have just undertaken a multi-hundred million dollar process to take sulfur out of diesel, which is, of course, a good environmental outcome. As a result of doing that, which is a federal mandate, we've had to significantly increase our CO2 emissions, which means that we will have to buy significantly more credits now as a result of previous federal action. As you've seen throughout the country, we are not aware of any other cap-and-trade system that has been contemplated in some of these regional programs that has included industrial sites like ours, or that include transportation fuels. And I can understand why you're discussing it, but to require a refinery to pay those credits as a result, when we have no impact on individual people's behavior, we would be paying for everyone's individual choices in how much gasoline, diesel, or jet fuel they use in their lives. And we think this is something you have to strongly consider, because we think it does make us somewhat unique as you look through this legislation. As I think many people have already said, we believe that this cap-and-trade system would just amount to a tax that we would be required to pass along to consumers for us to maintain our ability to stay in business. I think one of the other unintended consequences of a legislation like this, unless we take a look at the sectors and make sure we understand who we're putting in there, is what it's going to mean for future investment decisions that we will make in this state. When you have disproportionate legislation between different states, companies will decide which states to locate in and what types of industries to invest in. Until such time as we have a replacement for some of the transportation fuels that we currently have, and I know we've been talking a lot about renewables, and all of us are actively working together to get more renewables out into the marketplace. But in the meantime, we still have to drive our cars. We still have to, you know, get back and forth. We still have to fly airplanes. And so as we consider this and we talk about what consumers feel about the price of those transportation fuels, I hope you will consider that as this legislation and other programs move forward. You can read the rest of my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Brainard.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if Representative Knuth knows if any of the regional cap and trade systems are this inclusive in terms of the sector.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Brainard. The Northeast system is just the electric power sector. I'd have to look to some advice about the West Coast initiative. But I would just point out that in the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Accord, it does call for a multi-sector regional program that we're moving towards with the model rule. And if we do remember earlier testimony, the electric power utilities are supportive of more sectors being included. It's a way of making a bigger market, as well as making sure we get the reductions in the most cost-effective way, since transportation sector is, in very rough terms, about a third of our greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Schmidt. And next we have Mr. Wayne Brandt. Yeah. Welcome, Mr. Brandt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries. I guess I'm last on the parade tonight. I'm only thankful that the chairman's donkey wasn't walking in front of me in this parade. So, I want to apologize to the author. I haven't had a chance to speak with her about the bill, and I always hate to testify on someone's bill without having done that, so I'll get by and we'll chat about this. It probably comes as no surprise that we're not supporters of this legislation. It doesn't mean that every part of the legislation that Representative Knuth has brought forward is terrible. One item that has not been mentioned that we find encouraging for our sector of the economy, the forest and the forest-based sector, is that it appears to us that biomass energy generation is not included in this system. I think we're correct in that, and we thank you for that. If we're incorrect, we'll figure that out later. Some of the items that we think are missing have been mentioned: off ramps for economic conditions, rewards for early reductions, offsets have been talked about. We think that if the goal is to keep carbon or get carbon out of the atmosphere in our industry, and the forestry sector plays a significant role in that. I don't think the goal is to establish a cap-and-trade system. I don't think the goal is to, have one type of allowance system or another. I think the goal is to keep carbon out of the atmosphere to hopefully, reduce, limit climate change. So we think, anything that's targeted at that needs to recognize offsets, particularly the forest absorption of carbon, the forest products, storage of carbon. Carbon wood is 50% carbon by weight, stores the carbon for a long time. So we'd like to see that covered going forward. I don't think it's any secret that our industry is having some tough economic times right now. We've got all or parts of the plants shut down either permanently or temporarily in Bemidji and Cook, Grand Rapids and Deerwood. We are a large energy consumer. We're about 15% of Minnesota Power's load. I believe the Verso paper mill in Sartell is, after Schmidt's company, is the second largest load in the Xcel energy system. So energy costs are an important issue to us. In benchmarking our industry, we have two advantages over our competitors in North America and worldwide. We have more productive employees. That is a function of their skills, their education, their training, and their work ethic.
The other area that we've got to have a relative competitive advantage in is energy costs, specifically electrical rates. You know, if we get down to having only one advantage, we're even more broadly than those parts of our industry that are hurting are going to be hurting even more, and we know that the legislature doesn't want to see that happen. Our companies are national and international companies. That's the way our industry is. Didn't used to be that way. Wasn't as much that way when I started nearly 20 years ago, but they are. It's the way things have evolved. These companies have got options and decisions to make, which they make every day on where and how they're going to produce products. I do have a letter from Boise Cascade, which if we could pass that around, I'd appreciate it. They estimate, in all these estimates, they always get big ranges, they estimate for the International Falls Paper Mill that the cost of this legislation would be somewhere between $10 and $26 million a year, depending upon what assumptions you use. That's a big piece of money, particularly for a company that has an identical plant to the International Falls plant in Jackson, Mississippi. Construction was commenced on that after construction was completed. International Falls makes xerographic papers, exact same product. They also, I don't want to pick on Boise, but they're a good example. They also have a mill in St. Helens, Oregon, makes the same thing. Last year they were in competition for investment. This is the way it works in our industry anyway. Company's got X amount of capital, they're going to do these types of projects, and they've got different locations, and they decide where they're going to put it in. In this case, it was a sheeter, which is what takes big rolls of paper and turns it into this, and then wraps them up. Multi-million dollar investment, which unfortunately went to St. Helens, Oregon, instead of International Falls. We don't want to see that happen. It's particularly vexing when we look at it, and International Falls is a good example, because if we subject International Falls to some set of regulations, cap and trade, whatever it may be, the mill right across the river in Fort Frances, Canada, isn't going to be subjected to it. Unless we do this at least a national level, they're still not going to be subjected, but then we don't have the Jackson, Mississippi versus International Falls problem. So the bigger the scale, and one of the, there was a question earlier about, you know, why, you know, we need to do something, you know, at the state level, and we need to show action. And I agree that, you know, we need to be making progress on these issues, but there's some issues that are uniquely suited for dealing with at the state or local level, and there's some that aren't. We don't think this one is well suited at the state level. There are some issues that are best done at the national level, and it's just the nature of issues. So for us, it's an economic issue, it's a jobs issue. You know, we're pretty proud of what we've done in energy efficiency through the year. Some of our plants have received national awards. You know, we self-generate, or with our energy partners, 26% of the electricity that we use from renewable sources. We were doing that before the mandate last year. Unfortunately, I mean, we thought it was about last year about, you know, generating renewable energy. So we tried to see if we could get recognize that we were already beyond the 25% goal, but that didn't work out. I guess maybe it wasn't entirely about renewable energy use. We're proud of what we do with forest sequestration, you know, the forestry we practice, and the carbon that's sequestered in our products. So while we don't support this legislation, you know, we do look forward to working with you on solutions that don't disadvantage our sector, and we would be in the camp that looks for a national solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Totally surprised to me that the Minister of Forest Industry is testifying against this bill. And the reason is simple. You have the most to lose by climate change. We're losing our boreal forest. Everybody knows that. We've heard testimony again and again that Minnesotans can expect grasslands up north. And so why aren't you on the forefront of telling us we have got to do something about climate change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think there's a pretty broad range of opinion on the effect on forest lands and what Minnesota may look or not look like in 50, 60, 80, 100 years. I don't think that's a settled question. I think that the challenge in front of all of us you as elected officials, us as industry, and others, is to find solutions that allow us to continue to have a robust economy and a robust environment. We think 100% auction at the state level is going to have severe economic consequences. We're not sitting here and saying don't do anything about carbon emissions or efforts to further sequester carbon. That was not my testimony. So we want solutions that allow us, our employees, our communities to prosper while dealing with the issues.
Senator Wilgenius.
It's easy enough to say it's not a settled question because there are always outliers. But the good scientist, the one we have to rely on, the University of Minnesota, from Margaret Davies forward, have told us that our forests are the most vulnerable. We heard testimony in this same committee at least a dozen years ago from Margaret Davies, Dr. Margaret Davies, that our forests were the most vulnerable thing in Minnesota's climate change. That hasn't changed.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if that's a question or...
No, it's a statement.
Thank you.
Any other questions at all? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Brandt.
Thank you.
And Representative Knuth, I'll give you a final statement on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all the testifiers for coming today and for those who stayed until the end. Because we are talking about one of the greatest issues we have to deal with in the next 5, 10, 20, 50 years. And it's an issue that I haven't been arguing the we need to take action on global warming. I think we're all there. We've put that into our statutes. But I think it's also important to keep that in mind as we have these discussions because we are going to have to change. And we could be changing in ways that we don't control. We can be changing in ways that are more thoughtful, progressive, take into account the impacts not just on industries, which we've heard a lot of today, but on individuals. And I'm advocating for a change away from the biggest market failure the world has ever seen, according to Nicholas Stern, who is a former chief economist of the World Bank. And according to the Stern Report, which I'm guessing no one in this room has actually read the whole thing. It's 700 pages long. If we do nothing to address global climate change, what he estimates is, in this report, is a 20% reduction in the world economy. So you can avoid a lot of that with a 1% investment of our current world GDP. And I think that's an important point to note. We've heard a lot today about looking at this issue in terms of a wider context, in terms of other markets. I just want to make the point, we've heard the increase in rates, the increase in the price of gasoline. While I'm concerned about the increase in rates, it does show pricing, but it shows there is a price of carbon and putting it into the atmosphere that we all collectively own and benefit from. I'm concerned about the overall price that our consumers will pay. If they're using less natural gas, if they're using less electricity, if they're using less gasoline, they could be paying less even with a higher rate. And we want to help them make that transition. It's not necessarily fancy technology that's going to get us all this way. As one of our testifiers said, using some of, if we did a small percentage of auction for research and development, I actually have an article from the Financial Times that came out on Valentine's Day this year, and reporting on a study by McKinsey, which is a pretty well-respected global consulting firm that basically finds we can find profit in cutting emissions the half that we need to do because it's basically energy efficiency. You could hand those out. And it found that the second most energy inefficient sector in the world is the American housing market. We need to make that transition. As Representative Wilgenius' example with her brother's house and buying a bigger house but paying less than his energy costs. The question is, how do we do that? With 100% auction, which has been much of our discussion tonight. We've heard about the price increases and rates and gasoline and things like that. And if we put a price on carbon, which is what needs to happen to fix this huge market failure, we will see an increase in rates and gasoline. I can't dance around that. But the question is, where is that benefit in terms of that rate increase going to go? Without an auction, that benefit could go to the same industries that are currently who are currently controlling our current energy system. So what an auction allows us to do is make sure that those that value goes to a public benefit of making this transition to a new energy economy, using less energy, using different kinds of energy, attracting the businesses that we want in Minnesota, which are the green collar jobs we haven't heard because we don't have any of the representatives from those areas. In the stakeholder process, you all were handed a list of the people on the cap and trade working group, and they were appointed. They were appointed by the governor. Some members of the legislature attempted to get on and weren't allowed. I was very disappointed looking at that. There were no representatives from labor, the people who will be doing all of these jobs moving forward. And if we do hear, the AFL-CIO does have a statement of principles that were adopted that does support 100% of emission permits being auctioned with proceeds to benefit the public. And I think all of us received a letter from the IBEW that all the revenues accruing to the state for all sectors, passing a regional cap and trade system for all sectors with all revenues accruing to the state, and those to be used for public benefit, I think is a very important part of this legislation and something we need to be thinking about. It's not all the fancy stuff that we need to be doing. It's helping people do the nuts and bolts stuff, and that creates jobs, it creates wealth, it creates an insulation from a volatile, what we've already seen as a volatile price for all of our fossil fuels. Things that we can't control, our gasoline is going up without a carbon price. This allows us to insulate ourselves from that volatility, and I think that's a very important part of this legislation. We've also heard a lot about preferring federal action over state action. I actually think state action through a regional process particularly benefits the Midwest in terms of developing a federal system. We heard with the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, people who've been working on this, testimony that the regional systems will influence the federal process. We all know that the Midwest is different than the Northeast, is different than the West Coast. We have different industries, we have different needs in a cap and trade program. By making sure we've gone down the road of thinking about those needs, of developing what is a beneficial cap and trade program for the Midwest, I think we positively position ourselves in terms of a federal system, and I think that's a pretty strong argument for moving forward in the regional approach. I think I'll leave it at that in terms of why I support, my support for the bill, 100% auction in terms of making sure the public benefits from this very valuable asset, the global atmosphere, in terms of the many sectors included, that's allowing the market to look for the least expensive carbon reductions across the entire economy, not just within one sector, in terms of making sure our cap remains strong, in terms of not allowing offsets into the cap, because we already will be counting, if this gets developed the way the bill states with the principles, we'll be keeping everything in the cap that can be easily counted and verifiable. We'll still be investing some of that money into forest practices, agriculture practices, terrestrial carbon sequestration, things we want to be encouraging, things that there's still that we're still not sure exactly what the reductions are, but things we definitely want to be moving towards and benefits for many sectors of our state. And then finally, the not allowing more allowances at a certain price trigger. I think that's a pretty clear statement in terms of being able to trade with other regional systems, as well as making sure that we maintain the integrity of the cap. So I'll disclose, I was yesterday on the House floor, and our debate was responding to letters I'd received from high school students in my district from an environmental studies class. And one step of me said, I hope to never see the effects of climate change firsthand, and I hope no one in the world ever sees it. It's a big reason I ran for office. Frankly, it scares me. I try to be rational about it, and I am rational about it in my work and listening to all of these stakeholders. And that's the way we will actually get the job done. And we in Minnesota need to step up and do our part. We need to work with others, because this is a regional, national, and international problem. And I think we've heard some great suggestions tonight in terms of benefits for early reductions. I think we could take some advice from that in terms of how to make sure moving to an auction works works well with the market. And I will take advice, and I would also extend to Mr. Garvey and the governor's staff. We've seen the MTAG process. We've had group after group come up and be part of it. We have a whole bunch of legislators who could have benefited from learning through that process. The ones who have to actually implement the policy, the ones who are elected to represent the people of our state. And I would extend to Mr. Garvey that I'm sure there are legislators who could help you get a cap and trade system actually passed through the legislature, who would appreciate being part of the development of that in any way that you think would be beneficial. Because we do have to actually implement it here in the state, and it is important that we're informed about such a big change that will be changing our market to deal with one of the greatest challenges we have in the coming century. So with that, I appreciate, Mr. Chair, the chance for an informational hearing. I'm sure we'll be talking more about this in the coming days, weeks, months, and
Well, thank you, Representative Knuth. I appreciate your heartfelt and sincere efforts here, and we all know that you're motivated for all the right reasons here, and I'm hoping, too, that we can do something to move ahead, and certainly understand the desire to have legislative input in the negotiation process as we move forward, and to have that heard. We will be adjourning now until Tuesday or until Thursday, and we will be talking about this in the near future again. So, thank you. Meeting adjourned.